Tax Committee to order. First bill on the agenda today is Senator Kubley's Senate File 35. Senator Kubley, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Senate File 35 just takes a look at the things that would be exempt from the sales tax that pertain to farming operations. And with me today is L. Ray Anderson from Montevideo. Montevideo is the largest community in my district, Mr. Chair. It's a town of about 5,400 people, and it drops pretty fast after that. But anyway, he'd like to tell you about a problem that he's had, and I don't know if you can do anything with it because it would involve a retroactive thing, but I'd like to give him an opportunity to talk to you anyway.
Mr. Anderson, welcome. Please state your name for the record.
My name is L. Ray Anderson. I own Custom Ag Service out of Montevideo, Minnesota. I was born and raised in Kitson County up in the northwest corner of the state and on a farm family. And my parents taught me never lie, cheat, and steal. Went to Vietnam. When I graduated from high school, I was drafted and went to Vietnam and served in the infantry. In 1984, I started Custom Ag Service, which sells and services grain handling equipment. And I've been doing that ever since. In 1982, there were some tax changes, and the secretary requested that I go to Marshall, Minnesota, to the regional office and make sure that we were processing our sales tax and use tax properly because of the changes. She set an appointment up with me there. I did go into Marshall to the regional office. I met with a Tom Schulte. I explained to him that we were selling automated grain handling equipment, that we provide a grain dryer, wet holding tank, and cooling bins so that the farmer, it enables the farmer to go out, pick his corn, bring his corn in, dump it into a holding tank. The holding tank will automatically feed the high-speed grain dryer. The grain dryer will dry it down to about 20% hot and then move it into a cooling bin where it is finished and held for a 2-3 day period until it is 14.5%. And it can then be put into storage or delivered to the elevator for sale. After meeting with Tom and one of his people, they informed me that because all of the equipment that goes with the grain dryer is part of the grain drying process, that we should apply the same tax liability to all the components as that of the grain dryer itself. They also indicated to me if I built a grain bin, if it had a heater on it, it had all the equipment in it, that grain bin then would be considered a grain dryer. They even brought in their supervisor, discussed it, and when I left, that was what I took back to my secretary as information. Because she thinks that I don't do things right, she called in the State Department and verified it also that is, in fact, was what was expected of us. And everything was fine, and we ran until March 5th of 2003. We got a notice from the Department of Revenue indicating they wanted to audit our books for the sales and use tax information, which we opened up to them, set them up in an office, let them do whatever they want to do because we've been doing everything right. After a three-and-a-half-month period and five or six different trips from the gal that was doing the audit, several calls into the state to clarify what was taxable, wasn't taxable, it was determined that we hadn't been doing it right and that we should have been collecting tax on the grain bins, not the grain dryer, but the grain bins themselves. Well, then after another year or so of correspondence back and forth, it was determined that no, just the shell of the grain bin was taxable. Well, this has been going on ever since then. I was told by one of the people in 2004 it was determined that $94,000 was taxable and that we owed that $94,000. I was told that about $20,000 of that would be taken off because the accessories for the grain bins should not have been taxed. When I called then we got a letter about 6 months later indicating we owed $115,000. And so when I called to talk to the guy that said he was going to take the $20,000 off, I was told that it was turned over to somebody else, and about a week later we got a collection notice. So anyhow, this has been going on. I finally ended up, I hired an attorney to try to find some resolution to it at the same time that they committed to that my tax liability was $70,000. I had my secretary call in to find out, well, how do we collect the tax from the people we're selling to, and then how do we process the tax with the state? And after six or seven calls to different people, to this date, we still have not gotten an answer as to how we do collect it or how we pay it in. The end result of all of this is that in February of this year, my attorney and the Commissioner of Revenue's attorney met in front of the Supreme Court and argued the case. And in listening to it, it sounded to me like it was like 50-50, right or wrong, whatever it is. Yesterday I got a call from my attorney, and he indicated to me that the judges had ruled in favor of the court and that my tax liability would stand and that my store now owes whatever it is the state feels that I owe. And I'm guessing that's probably going to be, instead of the 64 they said originally, it might be $135,000 maybe. My attorney also indicated to me that I might as well look forward to letting them come in and look at my books and audit my books, and so that plus the last 3 years then that they're going to look at, I may have a $250,000 or so liability that I can't collect from anybody, and I don't know where it's going to come from, and I have no clue what I do next other than it is what it is. And so I'm here today just to explain what's happened. When I did call other people that were in similar businesses, I got seven no's that they didn't do anything with sales tax on grain bins. I got two that said they did, but they do a lot of commercial, and commercial is taxable. So I guess no matter what the outcome, I guess I'm asking that my state would support me a little bit in helping me keep my business intact, and that if nothing else, that the law is defined clear so that the law says it's a storage bin. They aren't storage bins, but the state is saying that I have to still tax the shell, but that I can't tax the farmer. And so at least that all of us are on the same playing field, that it is very simply and clearly laid out so that at least we are doing it the way it needs to be done, because this has been a very costly and time-consuming and it's kind of mentally fatiguing problem. And it's probably the single most problem I've had running my business. But that is the basics of it, so there you go.
It is what it is, right?
It is what it is.
Mr. Manson, here somewhere, Jack? Who from the department can get together with Senator Kubley and Mr. Anderson after to make sure that he doesn't lose his business over this? Senator Kubley, we'll find somebody with revenue to. Can we set something up with Senator Kubley and Mr. Anderson to make sure that we, if the law is not clear, somebody did not collect the tax, I think we need to be careful how punitive we are. So, Senator Kubley, I think somebody from the department will be in contact with you, and Mr. Anderson,
I appreciate that, Mr.
We'll try. We'll see if we can try to figure something out for you.
Thank you.
Senator Kubley, Senator Skoy has an amendment. Have you visited with him about that?
I did, and I'm willing to accept that amendment, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't have a copy of the amendment myself, but
he is doing his weekly radio show at home and will be down here shortly, but he has visited with you about it?
He has, yes.
And
I guess from the, you might be interested to know that both the Farm Bureau and Farmers Union both support the bill as it would be amended with Senator Skoy's amendment also. And they're both here, so they'd be willing to talk to the committee if you want them to.
If this is gone to.
Thank you.
Senator Coolby, we don't have a revenue estimate yet on this delete everything amendment, but we'll, so we don't know exactly how it changes the fiscal note on the bill, but as long as you, we know it'll go up some, but as long as you and Senator Skoy have agreed, who's the farm guy here? Senator Langseth moves the A2 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion trails. The A2 as adopted. Senator Coolby, you want to say anything further on the bill?
Well, I think that's really all that I have, Mr. Chair. And if you want to hear from anybody else, there are people here who would be willing to testify. Senator Moore has a question.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, is the fencing equipment, is the fencing material now out of the bill? It's still in?
Counsel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, actually, if you turn to page 3, section 4, it's in that, in line 6 and 7. It adds to the current fencing for farmed cervidae and adds all livestock. So it is there. It's just in a different place.
And, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear any testimony on the fencing materials, so I thought I would ask Senator Coolby, why was fencing material never considered? Well, I suppose when you talk about farm machinery, it does, you can't really quite fit into that definition. But
well, Mr. Chair and Senator Moore, it seems to me that the definitions around, you know, what qualifies as, you know, farm equipment and what doesn't in the actual production, but it does seem to me that if you're raising livestock, fencing is part of your production material. So, you know, I don't know, you know, to me the law is quite convoluted, and you know, maybe that's part of the reason I've never asked to be on the tax committee.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm learning some things every day, and, you know, I feel such at a loss when I'm looking at some language like this because there are words in here that I have never seen before. And so thank you, Senator Coolby.
Senator Moy, our sales tax exemptions that we've granted over time in a very piecemeal basis are very confusing, and we're headed down that same slippery slope with income tax credits. And someday I think the tax committee is going to have to spend some time looking at all the exemptions and credits we have and see if, in aggregate, there really is any kind of meaningful pattern to what we've been doing over the years.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Moy, I guess, you know, if you want to look at Minnesota Statute 297A, you know, I guess I read it over several times, and I still feel confused after having read it. So, you know, it's difficult for me to wade through the pieces, and, you know, the language is confusing, in my opinion. So we should probably try to clean that up, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the committee? Chair lays over Senate File 35 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Coolby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one more. Would you want to do that, or does somebody else
how long will it
go?
Take? How long will it take?
I don't think it'll be more than a minute or two.
Okay, go
I
ahead.
I have only one witness, and it's pretty short. It's 10-11.
Senator Coolby, Senate File 10-11.
This is Senate File 10-11, Mr. Chair and members, is a tax exemption for the installation of geothermal equipment. There's a Bob Donnelly here from Econor Systems, and if he could come forward, maybe he could say just a couple words. I don't think it would take more than a minute, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Chairman, Senators. Bob Donnelly with Econor Energy Systems. We're a Minnesota manufacturing company, and we manufacture geothermal heat pumps in Minnesota. Geothermal heat pumps are unique to the HVAC industry in that we move energy rather than create energy. That is, the energy we move is out of the ground. We use a natural ground heat, which is a renewable resource, pull that into the geothermal heat pump and use that as a source of energy. It's also a heating and cooling system within one cabin. We're a very small company. This is a very growing industry. A lot of excitement about geothermal these days. and I would encourage you to move this bill along. Our costs are higher than traditional HVAC systems in that we need to install a geothermal loop field in the ground. That additional cost does create additional expense, I should say, does create jobs for Minnesota in that we need well drillers or excavators to install that into the ground. And so I would encourage you to move that bill along.
Mr. Donnelly, the bill says that the equipment, the heat pump, and the charges for installation are exempt. Is the installation labor being taxed now?
No.
What? I don't know why it's drafted like that. Well, the bill summary says no, but it's kind of drafted like. Council, do we know? Is it? Okay. I think I have my answer to that. The labor is not taxable today. The bill's kind of drafted like it might be, but. Members, any questions? Costs $1 million. Senator Sindrum?
Mr. Donnelly, just, you know, you don't have to reveal costs or customers, but maybe thinking about your last installation, and I assume you do this, what might have been the payoff in terms of years of, you know, if you do this, it's going to pay off in so many years.
Right. The best payoff situation is for new construction for homes.
Okay.
And typically because you have a yard that's not established and we can excavate in the yard and install this geothermal loop field. If we're looking at different fuels, different payback and different fuels,
sure.
Depends on electric rates and natural gas rates and everything else. Typically, in Minnesota, generally against general electric rates and general power rates and natural gas, we're probably in the 7 to 8 year payback range against natural gas. Propane is probably in the 4 to 5 year range, and electric is probably about the same to 4 or 5 year range.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any else, members? Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1011 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Cooley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Donnelly. Chair and members.
Senator Sieben?
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1566. The effect of this bill would allow housing authorities to speed up the formal modification process for their TIF plans so that when a housing authority has the opportunity to acquire property for housing projects, they can do so more quickly, thus saving limited taxpayer dollars that go to these housing projects. And with me today is Mark Ulfers, the Executive Director of the Dakota County CDA, to speak more to the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mark Ulfers, Executive Director of the Dakota County CDA. This legislation would amend the Tax Increment Financing Act to allow agencies like the CDA to efficiently purchase sites for affordable housing in a fast-growing county where time matters. The legislation would amend the current law to allow for housing sites to be purchased by an administrative amendment instead of a formal plan amendment. It would continue to require CDA board approval and city public hearings related to land use approvals. Often when the CDA becomes aware of an opportunity to purchase an affordable site, it must move quickly. In recent years, the land market in the county has been very active and has been very difficult to purchase appropriate sites for affordable housing. Using current law, it can take 90 to even 120 days to process a formal TIF plan amendment. By using the administrative amendment process, this can be reduced to 30 days while still retaining appropriate public approvals. It should also be noted that this bill would only allow for use of this process in case where the sale is voluntary. In other words, not in the case where there's condemnation or eminent domain involved. In short, time is opportunity. The current law has caused us to lose several opportunities to purchase sites. In our market, land sellers are rarely willing to wait 90 to 120 days before entering into purchase agreements. Should this amendment pass, it would improve our ability to meet our affordable housing goals and provide needed housing for our modest income citizens.
Mr. Chair, are there any questions? That concludes our testimony.
Members, this is a change from current law in that we wouldn't require a public hearing for these purposes anymore.
There would still be a public hearing at the city level in our case. And the thing also about when a county does this sort of thing like the CDA is we have more public approvals than probably any other entity that does TIF because we require county board approval, city council approval, and in most cases you have only a city approving a district without county authorization as well.
Senator Steben, I think if we're going to do this, I think probably we'll narrow it up to your individual situation rather than broadly do it as a statewide policy. So we'll give that some consideration.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson?
Would this have to go to state and local?
Council tells me TIF bills generally don't do that.
Mr. Chair, it's a TIF bill, but it is a change of the procedure that they have to go through.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to emphasize, too, that this is dealing with existing proceeds of a TIF district, not creating a new district or expanding a district. So when you looked at your summary this morning and it talks about having some impact on revenue, I would take issue with that because this is using existing proceeds. It's the process by which you modify an existing district and use proceeds that have already been created by the district as opposed to expanding a district or creating a new district. It's very nuanced in that way.
Anything else, members? Chair lays over Senate File 1566 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Steven.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn.
Thank you. Thank you.
Scott, do you need? Senator Dibble. Senate File 1497.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1497 has to do with housing replacement districts. A number of years ago, a little over 10 years ago, a special kind of tax increment district was established for a few cities, Fridley, Richfield, Columbia Heights, Duluth, St. Paul, and Minneapolis. And the purpose of this is it's a kind of a scattered site housing replacement district, which allows those cities to acquire up to a certain number of parcels for the purpose of replacing them with market rate housing when those particular parcels are vacant themselves, or the house is vacant or structurally substandard. There are a few requirements that would remain. The only change that we're seeking is to increase the number in Minneapolis that could be designated into this housing replacement district, because the need, it's been very well used by the city of Minneapolis. The need is still there and, in fact, is growing. We have over 300 boarded and vacant houses in the city. And, of course, we know about what's going on in the subprime market with foreclosure rates and disinvestment, particularly on the north side of Minneapolis. There is a 25% match from non-tax increment sources that's required. Cities are constrained from using these sites for anything other than, like I said earlier, replacement housing at market rate. And so we're seeking to increase the number from 200 to 300 in Minneapolis. For the committee's information, we talk about on the first page, the Minneapolis Community Development Agency or its successors. It's because the Minneapolis Community Development Agency doesn't exist. It's now the Community Planning and Economic CPED. I always get it confused with CBED, which is another concept in the energy environment. CPED, Community Planning and Economic Development. Mr. Chair, I have Sherry Pugh from the Northside Neighborhood Redevelopment Council, who has worked with the city in developing the housing replacement plan and has been very involved in housing redevelopment in Minneapolis.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sherry Pugh Sullivan. I am the Executive Director of the Northside Residents Redevelopment Council. We're a 36-year-old resident council established after the 1968 rebellions that occurred after Martin Luther King was assassinated. Our organization has been about building community for those 36 years. And during that time, we've experienced some good and positive change in our community with other nonprofits, Project for Pride and Living, and the Greater Minneapolis Housing Corporation. In the 70s and 80s, we embarked upon building new houses and renovating many existing homes, totaling over 200, and changing the home ownership dynamic in our community, which was less than 25%, to now over 30% in one of our neighborhoods and 60% in the other. We also, at the same time, recognize that at times families are challenged because of family situations where a loss of a job or a health incident can challenge their home ownership. And so we engaged in mortgage foreclosure in the late 80s to help support and sustain families in their homes. And now that is a statewide program that the state and our city support in helping us to help those families who encounter troubles in maintaining their homes. But in the recent years, things have escalated in our community. We feel that we have been specifically targeted by predatory lenders and individuals seeking to flip houses. This has caused great harm in our community with individuals getting into loans that after 2 to 3 years are not able to maintain or people being put into homes that were over the value that that they were mortgaged at. And so what we're now seeing is the results of those activities, which probably started occurring in the mid-90s, in foreclosures. In 2005, the foreclosures in Minneapolis were 800. In 2006, they're almost 1,200. And over 50% of those are in North Minneapolis. And corresponding with that, as was mentioned, the city has almost 400 units on the boarded and abandoned properties list. 180 of those are in North Minneapolis. On Penn Avenue alone, if you were to drive between 20th Avenue to 27, you would see 14 abandoned homes. But not only do you see those abandoned homes, what you see is the results of what they cause. You see homes for sale because people get scared and think that they're going to lose value. We've seen spiked increases in crime in the community as well. And then there's also the disinvestment. For those who are there, they suddenly no longer feel that it makes any sense to keep investing in a home with abandoned buildings, for sale signs going up, and increased crime. So this legislation, and we would hope that you would consider increasing the number to 200 units, is critically important to the built environment in Minneapolis, specifically as I speak about North Minneapolis, where we feel we are in a crisis. We have older housing stock, and with that older housing stock comes many things that are difficult to maintain. Black mold, aging structures, asbestos, lead paint. And so we know that some of those structures, it is time. They've lived their good life, and it's time to replace them. This legislation would allow the city to assist and work with nonprofits in acquiring those homes, building new homes, and getting our community back whole so that we are a family-friendly community to live in. We feel this legislation is very important, and we hope that you would support it and consider the increase to 200.
Ms. Pugh, what percentage of the acquired properties are the buildings rehabbed on versus actually torn down?
I don't have that.
Mr. Chair, we do have Elizabeth Ryan here from the city's Planning and Economic Development Agency who could probably answer that question.
Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Ryan. I'm the Director of Housing for the City of Minneapolis, and I don't have that number with me. We could certainly get that for you, but I can speak to the properties that are in front of you at this point in time. Wherever possible, the city will rehab structures because in the long run it maintains the community character and is less expensive. In many cases, the most blighted buildings cannot be rehabbed. They must be torn down and new construction occur. I'm hesitant to guess. I didn't think to get that statistic before I came.
Are the majority rehabbed?
At this point, moving forward with the properties that are identified, I would say it's about 50-50, but that's a guess. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Dibble, you were kind enough to help me with my Coon Rapids Redevelopment Authority last year, and I do appreciate this bill. My question is, have you used up the 200 parcels, or do you see that you were going to, and that's why you're increasing it to three?
I think that is the case, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, Elizabeth Ryan can answer the question.
Thank you, Senator. Chairman, Senator, the use so far has been the first 100 have been used, and 37, I believe, of the second 100 have been used, and we anticipate completing that 100 by the end of 2008. But the reason that we're asking today for an additional 100, as well as I would support the request of Sherry Pugh and MCCD, is that we are undergoing a large effort to get to speed and scale to deal with this issue. The Northside Home Fund is a cluster effort that is working closely with nonprofits and for-profits in six identified areas in the city. One of them, the sixth cluster, are the properties in front of you today and the ones that Pugh mentioned on 10th Avenue. We are working to get a capital acquisition fund that can help us deal with the large number with the intent not to continue to intervene as a public entity, but with the intent that by strategic intervention at scale and with speed, the market will become a healthy housing market once again. The housing stock, by and large, in North Minneapolis is strong. It's very desirable.
Right.
There's mature trees and good neighborhoods.
Yeah, go ahead.
But the boarded and vacant buildings from every aspect, from focus groups we've done with realtors and developers, is an impediment to the healthy housing market, to people buying homes there.
Mr. Chair, I would like to respond to the information that Ms. Pugh Sullivan provided to us, and I think we've only got a few left in the existing district, and we've got 400 boarded buildings in Minneapolis. I was wondering if we could change that number on line 216 from 300 to 400.
And Senator Dibble, that they're going to reach 200 by what date?
I think yet this year.
For certain before the end of 2008. We, if I may, Senator and Chair, Senators, we are at the point of implementation of the city cluster strategy, as well as the other key partnerships we have in Minneapolis, for example, the Phillips Partnership. So it's anticipated there will be, with our capital acquisition, a large amount of activity. Most recently, within the past 6 months, we've put 30 parcels into the scattered site TIF at one time as potential for this program. And we will continue to do so, I think, at a much expedited rate. So the potential is there.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
so that Ms. Senator Dibble doesn't have to be back here in 09. I think 400 makes sense.
Senator Dibble, can you check with the city and see how they feel about changing that number?
Ms. Ryan is with the city.
I'd like to know what the mayor thinks.
All right. I'll check in with my mayor, Mr. Chair. All
right. I don't want to get out too far in front of Senator Pogelmiller's mayor.
Right. Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble and Senator Ryback, I mean, Mayor Ryback are so close, I'm sure they're going to agree. So if you're really looking to find out what others think, you should ask something, a different question.
Oh, Mr. Chair, there is some daylight between us from time.
We're operating on the fly here. So we need to just make sure we have the city council on board, that's all.
Right. It is a high priority on the part of the city council and the mayor. Ms. Ryan can speak. She's had some communication with the mayor.
Senator, thank you, Chair and Senators. I am here representing the city of Minneapolis today as the Director of Housing on behalf of Lee Sheehy, the Director of Community Planning and Economic Development, and on behalf of the mayor. And I did check with Patrick Bourne, our Chief Financial Officer, before coming as well.
We checked on 300, but let's circle back and check on 4.
We were aware and are here to support that as well. I was aware ahead of time.
Okay.
Can I make that motion, Mr. Chair?
Sure. Senator Dibble moves on page 2, line 2.16, delete 300 and insert 400. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no, motion prevails. Senator Dibble, thank you. Seems like a good project. You're doing good work.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Chair lays over Senate file 1497 as amended for possible inclusion. Senator Tomassoni has his bill up in finance, so we need to skip over and get him out of here this morning.
Thank
Senator
you.
Tomassoni, welcome back to the Tax Committee.
Thank
Senator
Pogelmiller,
Senator Tomassoni has an amendment.
And I miss you guys. Would Senator Pogelmiller offer the amendment? I'd really appreciate that.
Sure.
Senator Tomassoni, tell me what you and Representative Rukavina are trying to do here.
Boy, all the red flags came up.
I see your name's on the bill too, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and committee members, what... Senate File 1173 does that authorizes the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Boards to use funds from one of our funds, the Douglas J. Johnson Fund, which is the Economic Protection Fund, to purchase forest lands in the Taconite Assistance Area. Specifically, it says from the Potlatch Corporation in the bill, and the amendment we'd like to change that just from Potlatch and put it from any corporation that might be selling private lands. The idea here is when these big tracts of lands get sold up in northern Minnesota, that there becomes all this fragmentation of the forests, and the uses of the forests can suddenly be diminished for purposes of logging or for gravel removal or for recreational purposes. And so the attempt here is to, if in fact we end up doing this, that we will be able to then buy some tracts of land and continue the logging, continue the gravel use, or continue the recreation purposes that they might be used for, so that the potential private owners that might buy these big tracts of land or buy little pieces of these lands don't fragment the forests, and that they can be continued to be used for what they're being used for now.
Senator Tomassoni. The Douglas J. Johnson Trust Fund. Senator Tomassoni, who was responsible for renaming that from the 2002 fund? There seems to be a little dispute on the Senate Tax Committee. If Representative Abrams was responsible for changing the name, or Senator Pogelmiller was?
Well, I'd say Senator Pogelmiller. I don't know.
Judge Abrams is taking some credit for it on the street.
I do remember they were both on the conference committee together. So that wasn't one of those conference committees I stayed with until 4:30 in the morning, though, so I don't really remember that.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I was on the conference committee, and contrary to what everyone thinks, maybe I was the one who did it.
Senator Johnson is watching this.
Mr. Chair.
Brown chair. Senator Langston.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, this seems to fit in a little bit with the forest legacy, somewhat the same idea. Potlatch was going to be coming out with selling quite a bit of their land, I know, and we've been requested to be looking at bonding money. Well, we did last time. Wasn't it Potlatch we were buying about 50,000 acres from? Not buying, some kind of a lease arrangement where it could only be used for forestry purchases. But this apparently is part of that.
It's very similar. I think at one point in time there was like 305,000 acres that was put up for sale. And Cabela's actually either bought it or is marketing it or has leases to it or whatever. And so the fear is that you're going to have all kinds of little pieces of property in the middle of these forests that are owned by private owners. And then to try and get the forestry industry or the recreation industry or the gravel industry to actually be able to use these plots of land, you're going to have all kinds of problems because they're going to be all cut up. And so we just want to have the ability to potentially buy these tracts of land so we can keep the continuity of the forest together.
Senator Pogomar.
And the money that would be transferred is money that lease of the land after you've purchased it, or what money is being transferred into the fund?
It would be if there was, for example, logging going on, or if there
right.
was gravel.
Okay, so it proceeds. Yeah. It's proceeds yeah. from whatever right. happens once yeah. that purchase has been made.
Would go
right.
back to the fund.
Yeah.
Right.
The thought, members, just is under current law, the trust fund cannot purchase land in its portfolio with the trust. This would just allow the purchase of land to be part of the investment component, and any proceeds off that land would flow back to the trust, much like interest does on equities or other investments. Senator Pogomar, Senator Pogomar moves to A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Any other questions of Senator Tomasoni? As long as we got him here, we probably won't see him the rest of the session. Senator Pogomar.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that that's blank because we don't exactly know how much money will be needed to purchase the property, I think. So
Senator Pogomar, we're not actually contemplating any property right now, so I don't know.
This is more permissive language to be able to do this.
Just do this. Just save money.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogomar, I think the way it would probably work is that if we do enter into some kind of agreement to purchase some kind of land, then whoever's selling the land will have a price, and then we'll have to figure out how much it'll cost.
Senator Pogomar, our counsel has a suggested amendment there. Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, members, the amendment would be on page 1, line 17, delete up to blank dollars of the amount and insert money.
Senator Pogomar.
Did you take out the amount out also?
Yes.
I'd move that.
Pogomar moves the oral amendment on line 17. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1173 as amended for possible inclusion. Senator Tomasoni, thank you.
Thank you. Members.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here this morning on behalf of Senate File 1979, which is a bill which would include logging tires in the exemption for sales tax for repair and replacement parts for certain types of equipment, farm machinery, logging equipment, and other types of aquaculture production equipment. And I believe, do the members have the photograph? I'm going to pass around some photographs so that the members can see an example of the type of tire we're talking about. These are not typical tires. They're often over 6 feet tall. With me here today to explain the policy, the tax policy reason for including these tires in the exemption is Mr. Mike Robertson.
Mr. Wayne Brandt.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Thank you, Senator Olson, Chairman Bach, members of the committee, Wayne Brandt again, and thank you for considering this bill. You can see on the pictures as they come around that the tires that we're discussing are fairly unique and fairly large. On the first picture, the gentleman that's moving the tire is a pretty big boy. He's about 6 feet 5 inches tall, and I dare say that any of us in the room could readily hide behind him. You can see in the second picture one of the tires, one of the high flotation tires, next to a sedan at one of the tire dealerships in northern Minnesota, and then the actual tires on a skidder out in the woods, and then finally tires a little smaller that are on a cut-to-length processor. These tires are essential to the equipment that is used to harvest trees. They are unique in that they are designed specifically for such equipment and are marketed for that and have unique design specifications for minimizing the impacts on the soil and the ground as they're utilized so that they can protect the environment. They also are clearly an integral, in our view, an integral input into producing the final taxed products that come from our industry, that is paper, lumber, and engineered wood products. Finally, they are not cheap. Tires themselves, the narrower ones that the big fella in the first picture is moving around, those are about $12,000 for a set of four, and the wider ones are about $20,000 for a set of four. So we respectfully request your consideration of this legislation. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Mr. Brandt, when a logger buys a new skidder, it obviously has tires on it. So when he buys a new skidder, they are exempt, but when he replaces tires, they're not?
Mr. Chairman, it is my understanding from the Department of Revenue that you are correct. They are exempt when the equipment is originally purchased as part of the unit, but not when purchased for replacement purposes.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is to Council. Is there any other type of tire, like in the taconite mining industry, or any other tire we exempt currently?
I think I know the answer, Senator Johnson. The tires on mining equipment are exempt.
10, 11.
Thank you. 1 and 2. Senator Olson?
And Mr. Chair, I think you'll notice that there's a relatively small fiscal note on this. I think it's $28,000 for 2008. And I know that you're aware of the difficulties with the logging industry and that this would be a good way to put some relief most directly toward those who have been affected.
Senator Olson, this isn't going to keep many loggers in business if they're tipping on the edge of bankruptcy.
Well, I understand that, Senator Bach. Mr. Chair.
It is, Mr. Chairman, if I could just intercede, though. You know, one of the things for over the long term for people that are in the business and doing the right things environmentally that can be helpful.
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair, when the time is right, I'd like to move the bill.
Any other questions, members? Senator Moore moves that Senate file 1979 be laid over for possible inclusion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. If you're no,
thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Olson, I'll bet your next request to the Tax Committee will be bigger than $28,000. I think Senator Olson gets the prize for bringing us the cheapest bill for this session.
I mean, she gets it, right, Mr. Chairman?
Well, we should be able to accommodate her.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sundrum.
It's probably, I should have asked this, but as the bill talks about maintenance and repair of logging equipment, I mean, we see these whatever they call these things that pick up logs. But, you know, would this also include the truck that hauls them and the other kinds of tires?
Mr. Brent?
Or are we just talking about this kind of a tire?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Senjum, it's our intent, and I believe the language is clear that it does not include truck tires.
Okay. The bill reads, used in the maintenance and repair of logging equipment, and I don't know, that seemed kind of broad. But
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, I don't believe under the law or under the department's rules that trucks used to transport wood are considered logging equipment.
Okay.
Logging equipment is separately defined.
Thank you. I should have asked it when you were there. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Senator Vandeveer here. Senator Vandeveer, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you.
Senator Vandeveer, Senator Langseth just had a maybe we should put an income tax increase on it and send it to the floor. It's a funny committee.
On per diem, Mr. Chair.
Senator Vandeveer, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a pretty simple bill. It's currently in statute, when a township becomes a city, the PILT payments that they may be receiving go to, I then revert to the county and the school district. All this bill does is say that after January of 2000, when a city, or 2006, when a city becomes, or a town becomes a city, then the PILT would stay with the city. No one that we talked to knew why they would give up the PILT at that time. And so all this does is make that simple change, members.
Members, DNR suggested an amendment, BV0054. Maybe we'll pass that out. And Senator Skoy moves the DV0054 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Has Senator Vandeveer seen this amendment?
It's the hunting amendment, Senator Vandeveer.
Hunting amendments are good, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So I do support the amendment.
Council, explain the amendment for us.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members, the amendment would put a condition on the continued receipt of the payments in lieu of taxes by the city after it's been incorporated, so that the payments will continue to be made to the new city only. They would terminate if the governing body of that city passes an ordinance that would prohibit hunting within the boundaries.
Senator Vandeveer, that's acceptable?
It is, Mr. Chair, and I don't believe, we do have someone from Columbus here who could give us their position on the amendment.
Danny Peterson, Councilman Columbus. I'm vaguely familiar with this here. I've just been brought, I'm new on the council, so I'm kind of like a lot of you learning the position here. And I cannot see the reason why this bill is not not going the way it should be going. Some money should come back to Columbus, come back to any town that has became a city, because the county's for it, the DNR is for it, and there's no reason why it should not read that way in a new law.
The DNR's issue is currently hunting is allowed there, and they're a little concerned that the city would be under the city's authority to prevent hunting within their corporate city limits. Do you know what the position of the council is? Is there any intent to prohibit hunting if it's
No, there's not. We've worked with the DNR quite often. In the city of Columbus, DNR is a major landholder in the city of Columbus, and we work with them any way we possibly can. We had a good relation with the DNR quite a few years, and we hope to continue that relationship good with them.
Senator Vandiver.
Mr. Chair, I'm told that the mayor of Columbus did testify in support of this amendment in the House, and I do have the clerk, city clerk is here, and she could testify to relating to that if you'd like.
To the amendment?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'd also like to comment, before redistricting, I used to represent Columbus, and it's woodsy, it's beautiful hunting country, and I don't think they're going to change it.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Elizabeth Mersko, and I'm the city administrator for Columbus, and we do support the amendment. We have met with the DNR, and we fully understand that if the three wildlife management areas, if we pass an ordinance to the effect that would not allow hunting, we realize we would lose our PILT money.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably need a refresher on these PILT payments, but are there other activities that occur on these state-held lands that should also continue, or the PILT payments really tied to lands that are used for that kind of recreation?
Senator Vandiver.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that this is just impacting the state lands there, but not that we're aware. I don't know if
the
city administrator has a comment.
Public lands.
It is public land. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, are there other, I mean, I understand hunting would be definitely a concern within a municipality, because lots of municipalities don't want hunting to go on, but is there any other kinds of activities we should be worried about?
Mr. Meyer, can you alleviate the committee's concerns? What state land are we talking about here, and what other activities are permitted on this property now?
Mr. Chair, members, most of the land that's there is Carlos Avery's Wildlife Management Area. So all of the uses that are allowed on a wildlife management area, hunting, hiking, bird watching, things of those natures. And it is something that we were able to work out with the township or with the city now. I apologize for that. That will protect our interests. The land that, or the language they're amending is in Chapter 97 dealing with the wildlife management area PILT payments. It's not in 477 dealing with the overall DNR acquired lands. So the land, the management purposes of these lands are, the intention is to allow hunting on them. So we just wanted to make sure that if for some reason that would ever be ceased to exist, that the PILT under this section would not be eligible. They would still be eligible for PILT under DNR acquired lands, Chapter 477A.11 through 16, I believe. So it's a little comfort language for us out there as development does occur and encroachment does occur on these areas, to make sure people are aware of the purpose of those lands.
Well, Mr. Chair, what about those ordinances that prohibit bird watching?
That would be a friendly amendment.
On amendment number 54, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Anybody else want to testify?
We do have the Commissioner Sivaraja, who can discuss the county's position.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As far as the county goes,
Your name for the record, please.
Rhonda Sivaraja, Anoka County Commissioner. Anoka County is supportive of Senate File 1937. In the early 1960s, our townships were given many of the powers that cities are given, and they have very much functioned like a city over the years. And so just the fact that they'd be transitioned officially from being a township to a city, we see no reason that their PILT payment should now suddenly come to Anoka County. So we are very supportive of this effort.
Any other questions, members of the committee? Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 1937 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Vandiver.
Thank you very much.
Your witnesses.
Mr. Chair, my witnesses are waiting.
Senator Chaudhry here?
He's gone.
Senator Chaudhry has his own personal committee this morning. Senator Chaudhry? Senator Johnson?
Just for you, though.
Well, that's the message we got.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. This is Senate File 705. It's for federal government employees to receive a deduction on their income tax return. We've listened to Senator Bickerman's bill similar to it for the military earlier this session, and we'd like to add to the conversation today. I have Carl Frank and Al here to speak on behalf of their bill. And they can introduce themselves and speak to the bill. Thank you.
And members, the fiscal note is coming out. Senator Johnson, have you seen the fiscal note?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
How much is it?
It's $67 million. But, Mr. Chairman, the retirees will testify that there is a balancing act here that they'd like to talk about.
Okay. Good morning, Chairman Mock and members of the Tax Committee. My name is Frank Blake. I'm a resident of Elk River, and I'm vice president for the state of Minnesota as far as legislation goes for our association, which is the National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees. And as you may recall, in the 2006 session, we had a bill asking for a $40,000 exemption. At that time, it was too costly. It never got to the floor. And so we came back with a bill that is a lesser amount of a $10,000 exemption along with 20% of the annuity that we received. I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me to testify here in support of 705, and especially I want to thank the author of the bill, Senator Johnson, as well as the co-authors. Now, I represent 42,000 federal employees as well as 26,000 federal retired employees. The bill, however, does include exemption for anybody 65 and over that's a municipal employee, a retiree, state retiree, or federal retiree. So we're covering all retirees that have served well in their jobs that they had, either with the state or with the county, the village, whatever. Now, I'd like you to consider this bill as an economic development initiative. The key issue in retirement seminars, and I speak at a few of these seminars, one of their key issues is selecting the retirement location regarding state income tax. We have at the present time, there are 9 states with no state income tax whatsoever. There's 15 that totally exempt the civil service annuities, and there's 16 other states that exempt from 12,000 to 31,000. We're one of the few states that doesn't have an exemption for annuitants from the state or the federal government. And there are also 26 states that exempt the Social Security in full. A recent study at the University of Arkansas did an economic analysis indicating an average retiree brings in $250,000 in assets. If time allows, Carl will be elaborating on this as far as the calculations. I'd appreciate it if all of you would take the time to review this handout when and if you have time. Most recently in the Star and Tribune, Government Plenty had an article in there about a military retirees leaving the state of Minnesota. We feel the same in the federal retirees. We have at least 10% that leave the state. That's a conservative estimate. In the area where I live, in an association with about 150 homes, we have 13% of our people that leave for 6 months during the winter months. And we also have another handout showing that. The many states now consider recruitment and retention as an industry, and I'd like to see Minnesota do that. We hear it all the time on radio about South Dakota. They call that Minnesota nice, without taxes. And one thing is, if you look at your handout right now, NARF states that want you. There's 5 states listed in there that are recruiting retirees because of the income that it brings into that state. And one of those states is Florida, which already is a state that has no state income tax, and yet they're doing a lot of recruiting for that reason. There's a Retirement Life. That's the magazine. It's a monthly magazine that we have in our association. Another thing you can look at is the health insurance of federal and state retirees are pretty well off, and it won't cost the state in that respect. Environmental problems, retirees versus the industries, much safer for the people that come in that are retired. We also have I think in 2004, PARA had a statement out in their newsletter that 9% of their retirees are leaving the state of Minnesota. And if you take a look at that, they're only one-third of the public employees. And a loss in excess of $6 million per month because of those people leaving the state, that money that is not spent here in the state of Minnesota. And that amounts to $230,000 per day that we're losing in spendable revenue here in the state of Minnesota. I think you have to take this into consideration, and that's why I'd like you to very scrutinize the economic analysis that comes from the state of Arkansas. So there is a handout on that. Another thing I'd like to bring out is the baby boomers, which are retiring, and a lot of them will be leaving the state of Minnesota. Minnesota has to take a look at this. And that influx of the baby boomers will cost the state a lot of money as they leave our state for residents in other states. And in my conclusion, I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me to testify at this hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blake. Additional testifiers?
Yes, sir.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Carl Walker. I live in Roseville, Minnesota. I've been there for 35 years. I've been retired for 17 years. And I would like to open my statement by saying that our bill is non-political. All three of us are volunteers. We're not paid lobbyists or of that sort. All three of us worked in different departments within the government for over 30 years and served our government well. I consider this, as to my fellow members of the IRS retiree group, an equity and economic benefit issues, exactly two issues. Minnesota taxes the federal retirees in entirety and total, whereas Social Security beneficiaries receive an exemption. I have given you a handout and where I made some calculations to compare, and I'm not going to talk about that too much here, but you can study it on your own time, your fare. I believe that this is very unfair to a certain class of people. And it could be fixed in two ways. You can either give the federal employee retirees a tax subtraction or exemption or whatever you want to call it, or tax Social Security benefits in the entirety, which would lower the entire tax base for everybody. Regarding the economic benefit, I have seen this Minnesota Department of Revenue's calculation, which shows that it'll cost the state $65.5 million annually. We have talked to several of you and others who are concerned about this because it's a revenue loss, but we feel that it is an offset here because I took 10% of the federal retirees from which I can find numbers, and also we know of the PARA people that retired. So that's about 75,000 people. Of which 10% of those leave, you have a loss of about $127 million to $200 million a year, which an income, which definitely is an offset to the cost that you have. So, like Frank says, this should really be taken a good look at. Our federal employers are really hurting. On that first page of my handout, I have made some calculations, and these are accurate. Gas in 2003 cost $1.60. This morning I saw it on the pump at $2.61. We all have to drive. If we just drive, use one tank of gas a week, we basically wipe out our retirement benefit, and we have to drive in the state. Utilities have jumped 29%, medical insurance 42%, Medicare insurance 37%, and property taxes, which has a lot of discussion in the state right now, 44%. So we are really hurting when we're only getting a 3.3% annual increase in our COLAs. Actually, if you look at one of my charts in the fact sheet, you will see it constant decline since 1984. Our expenses have been going up. So we're hurting. We need some kind of help in this. So with that regard, I just ask you to look at my fact sheet. Read it carefully. I took some time to calculate it. And thank the committee for listening to me. I particularly thank Senator Johnson and the others that have signed on to bring it before you. Please take a good look at this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Locker. Sir?
Yes, my name is Al Schacht, and I'm a federal retiree. Worked in the U.S. Forest Service, most of it in Washington, D.C., but I retired as head of fire control for the United States. And I came back to Minnesota and joined NARF and became very active in the federal retirees group here. This bill that we brought before you, and thank you, Senator Johnson, for doing so, is badly needed. It's something that I feel very strongly about, but what's happening is we're losing our people. We're losing our expertise. We have people that are retiring and leaving Minnesota. We lose that volunteerism, those people that contribute to the society and economy of Minnesota. Now, that's not talking about the financial aspect. There's very little infrastructure required to keep retirees, so other states are recruiting them actively, and they're getting them, and that's the problem. They bring them into their state, and they take all their life savings. They take their Minnesota retirement income. They take their seller houses. They take that investment, and they take it to another state, and they benefit from it. And Minnesota loses on this, and that bothers me as a native of Minnesota. Incidentally, I was born and raised in Rochester, and I live in Hammond, Minnesota, which most of you probably don't know where that is, but it's in southern Minnesota, southeast Minnesota. One of the things that that Carl mentioned, and so did Frank, is that the dollars that are lost to Minnesota could stay in the Minnesota coffers. That's important. As finance scores this, they score it as a negative because they don't look at the positive. And that's an objection that I have personally, because there is a positive. By keeping these people in Minnesota, we save that income here. And it'll contribute to the economy of Minnesota. And it far exceeds what the cost of this bill is by the exemption. I want to thank Senator Johnson and members of the committee for listening to us. And we also have Gene Gere here from the State Employees Association.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gene Gere. I'm a retired state employee, having a 35-year career with the state of Minnesota. I'm here representing the Minnesota Retired State Employees Association, MRSEA. It's an organization of about 8,000 retired state employees from the diversity of state agencies, revenue, administration, finance, human services, MnDOT, et cetera, including former legislators. In fact, we currently have one former legislator on our board of directors, and at our upcoming election, we will have two former legislators on up for election on our board of directors. The major purpose of our organization is to promote and protect the economic, social, and political issues of retired state employees, and MRSEA, by action of its board of directors, sent a letter to all legislators dated April 17, 2006, in support of this legislation during the 2006-2007 legislative session. We reiterate our continuing support of this legislation today. Public retirees in Minnesota, like all retirees, face continued economic pressures for escalating costs. But that is only one of the issues, we believe. As you've already heard, most states provide public retirees with state income tax exclusions in recognition of dedicated public service careers. Based on information from the National Conference of State Legislatures, only eight states tax Social Security to the full extent of federal taxes, Minnesota being one of those. All states except eight partially or totally exempt state pension incomes from state income taxes, Minnesota being one of those, along with California, Connecticut, Indiana, Nebraska, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Wisconsin. And only four states have no exclusions for public pension incomes or Social Security. We think it's time that Minnesota move forward in this area. Minnesota's income tax policies is driving Minnesota public retirees out of the state that they dedicated their careers to, which is causing certainly hardships. Just one example, Minnesota retired state employee, or Minnesota MSRS, which is the pension program for state employees, which is a small part of the total employee retiree programs, PERA and TRA, the teachers and the local government retiree organizations are much larger, but just the MSRS state is about 26,000 retirees. Approximately 9% of them are no longer Minnesota taxpayers. They have left this state for probably a variety of reasons, part of it being the tax issue. That represents about $40 million a year going outside of Minnesota. Now, that's just a small part of the total, and we believe that it's about time to stop the exodus of public employees from Minnesota in search of more tax-friendly states. 26,000 state retirees urge your support of this bill.
Mr. Geer, as a matter of public policy on treatment of pension income, why would I give preferential tax treatment to a city or county employee on their pension and not to one of Senator Olson's constituents who was just here in the logging community? Why is it more important to exempt pension of a public employee versus somebody in the private sector? I don't quite understand the rationale why that's good policy.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that that kind of public policy can be debated forever. We have, I think, a group of employees that have committed a career to the state of Minnesota. It seems strange that we would drive them out of the state through our tax policies.
Mr. Chairman, if you'll review the one handout that Carl gave you, it shows that the private employer that's retired under Social Security, he has a $49,000 exemption, along with his Social Security and any other type of investment income that he may have. So the private sector is covered under that. I can cite an example where they perhaps are getting much more than we are as federal retirees. I worked at Honeywell for several years, and I gave up my employment there. I was making $201 an hour, and this was back in 1951. I joined the Postal Service at 99 cents an hour, and we had tough sledding. I had to carry two jobs for many years until in the 60s when we finally got a little better income. So that's the site where I can show you that Social Security recipients are doing better than the average letter carrier or clerk in the Postal Service.
Well, I understand the federal pension issue. Where I'm struggling is with school teachers or city employees or county employees who also have Social Security. I mean, that's where I'm struggling. I'm not struggling with the federal employees to the degree with kind of the broader scope of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know. They're in the bill.
I understand they're in the bill. I'm wondering why.
Okay, let me explain on that Social Security. I don't know if you're familiar with the GPO or WEP. People that retired after 1985 lose up to 60% of their Social Security income, even though it was earned. They lose that because of the government pension offset, because they were a public employee, and this does cover school teachers, municipal employees. If you have Social Security earnings while you were an employee with the state or after retiring, you lose part of that Social Security benefit.
And that's prior to or after what date?
Anybody that retired after 1985, beginning January 1, 1986. And by the way, our association at the national level has been fighting this GPO web bill for at least 8 years, every year. We cannot see to have that repealed.
And that's a federal law?
That's a federal law, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Part of my closing, I'd like to let you know that Carl, less than a month ago, had open heart surgery in the state of Minnesota. I think that their biggest issue is, along with the reasons for wanting to stay in the state, they want to be with their families during their health care issues, and the health care, the monies provided in health care, would be a huge offset in itself.
I know we've heard often that one of the reasons that seniors stay here is because of the quality health care that Minnesota has. And part of the reason we have that quality health care system is because we invest money in it. And other states don't invest in health care to the degree the state of Minnesota does. So and there's a cost to that. And it's difficult to... I mean, we have seen sales tax exemptions, income tax credits. Gentlemen, nobody wants to pay taxes anymore. Everybody is in here. We've got a couple thousand bills introduced this year, and there's been a couple hundred of them come to this committee, and guess what? People don't want to pay. But at the same time, they want good roads. You know, they want good medical facilities. And I don't quite under, they want good schools. I as the taxpayer, don't quite understand the disconnect between the money that we invest as a state, you know, because all we do is recycle the money here. I mean, money comes in, and we decide who should get it, and we send it out. And I don't quite understand the disconnect. But we've certainly seen plenty of that this year. It seems like advocates have figured out that we don't have much money, and there really isn't a surplus, so they're not asking for appropriations. They're just instead asking to have their tax liability reduced, which, you know, kind of does the same thing. But Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It kind of reminds me of a group of people that were in my office just last week. They happened to represent a labor union, and they were coming to call on a conservative Republican. And as they were talking, after we got done with discussing labor issues, I said, are there any other issues you're concerned about? And they said, we want universal health care. I said, great. You know, and I said, now, but you just got done telling me that you wanted your taxes cut. So who should pay for that? I said, oh, the government should pay for that. And I turned and I said, I'm going to do everything I can to help the taxpayer of the state of Minnesota. And they looked at me and they said, you're my kind of Republican to vote for. Now, I think there is a disconnect. At the same time, I think Senator Johnson, her bill is reflecting an observation that I've begun to see people who are stockbrokers that do the investments for seniors are beginning to find the same observation. Our seniors are considering moving, and they are moving out of the state because of the income tax impact on their limited income. So I think that's a real observation, and it's a real problem if we let it go too far. We don't want to lose the potential income that's generated from our seniors by other means. They pay sales tax. They may be taking care of some estate issues as they get older. They want to stay here because all their loved ones, their kids and grandkids are here. They don't want to leave. And what the investment houses are telling me is they're seeing people leave to go to these other states that have limited or no income tax, and it's very tempting for them. And if you're on maybe the western end of the state, it may be tempting to just go across the border to get into that type of a tax treatment and yet still stay relatively close to loved ones. But you know, even though I was born in South Dakota, I don't necessarily want to live there. And I like the benefits of Minnesota. I have to admit that. But it is a real problem, and I think it's something that we're going to have to wrestle with, because what's happening as a further observation is once our seniors begin to start realizing some health issues that are really serious, they all of a sudden come back when in the upper 70s and early 80s, when those issues become more prominent, they start coming back to Minnesota to take advantage of our good graces of promoting good health care here. And so we lose that income for 10, 15 years because they go somewhere else. And then when the expenses come up, they come back here, and then we pay out. So we do, it's a definite problem. I've talked about it for just about a year and a half, 2 years, because I'm beginning to piece, the observations are becoming numerous. And Senator Johnson at least is trying to present some idea that at least recognizes the problem. We're going to pay one way or the other. I'm fearful of that. I know this is a costly proposal, but it's going to be costly to the state when the income tax leaves also.
Senator Limmer, do you think that the, you know, the average public employee that's got a pension and they're paying a little income tax on it, do you really think they save money on their retirement when they move to pick a state, Florida, South Dakota, the taxes clothing and taxes food? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if retirees, the kind of the average retiree with a reasonable pension, mm-hmm. ever sat down and put a pencil to it and figured out, gosh, when I go to the grocery store, I'm paying sales tax, and I don't have to do that in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. When I go to buy a new jacket in Minnesota, I don't pay sales tax. But if I do it in South Dakota or in Florida, I do pay sales tax. I wonder if people really put a pencil to it when they retire.
Yeah.
And maybe people would rather pay sales taxes. Yeah. Maybe people would rather pay sales tax at the grocery store. But I can tell you personally, I don't know how long I'll be taxed here. I might be done in a month. But as long as I'm here, we're not taxing food in Minnesota.
Yeah.
But other states do it.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I've asked the same question myself, and I don't know if they're really putting pencil or paper to it, but I do know in observing observing the purchase habits of senior citizens, buying new clothes, buying extravagant meals is not always in their lifestyle anymore. I have a 15-year-old daughter. If you want to see an example of spending habits, it's far different than our seniors by all means. But you're right. I don't think anyone, or some people don't put pencil to it. But my investment brokers are telling me some people are, and they are putting pencil to it, and they are making these decisions. So it's something that I think our committee is going to have to wrestle with in the near future, because we're just beginning to hit the big balloon of baby boomers hitting retirement. And the baby boom generation is a little different. These folks are not part of the baby boom generation, but the new retirees are. And if you think back on their lifestyle, and it's been a rather luxurious one compared to other generations that have ever preceded it in what they've received in life, they have high expectations. And if that high expectation and their higher educated than any other previous generation, they know there's options, and that's what they're looking at. So it's a good public discussion to have at this time and in the next few years, because it's coming at us, and I think if we don't do something, we're going to lose the income one way or the other. And I'd rather keep the continuity of our seniors here in the state of Minnesota. It builds good families. It keeps that relationship of our grandparents with their grandchildren, and that's vitally important too. So,
but Senator Limmer, I think. Retirees still have some obligation to pay. And if it's true that they don't purchase a lot anymore because they kind of have everything that they need, so we don't get much sales tax because they're not like they don't have 15-year-old kids that are buying a lot of stuff. Where is their obligation to help pay for the things that we fund, or do they not have one? Well, you know, once you retire,
Mr. Chair, if we're just having this kind of discussion, they may say that their obligation has been made over the last 75 to 80 years of their life, and that now that those productive years are no longer as productive, and they keep seeing the high cost of critical expenses going up far beyond the rate of inflation, far beyond the rate of cost of living increases on their pension statements or their Social Security, they may be saying is, help, we can't do it here anymore, and as much as we love to live here, we gotta stop the bleeding somewhere. And you know, Senator Johnson's bill introduces not only the issue but a potential cure. It's not the total cure, and on first blush it may be considered grandiose, but in the same respect, it points at the problem that's coming at us really fast.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to also interject. They do still pay property tax, and they do add to the health care system. My dad probably takes 20 drugs in a day to manage all of his health issues. So I think there are areas they're really putting in the dollars.
But, Senator Johnson, as you well know, we don't receive any of those property tax dollars on residences. That's not the money that we're spending here. And I think the seniors are probably our strongest argument for providing property tax relief, because I do think property taxes are becoming a real burden for people on fixed incomes, and that is, frankly, a large part of my passion to try and provide some property tax relief this session for homeowners. Because I understand it is a serious issue.
Yeah, good. I'd like to add something.
Your name for the record, please.
My name is Carl Locher. Folks, can you hear me?
Your name again? No, you have
Carl
to closer.
Locher.
Locher, okay.
You indicated a while ago that we have excellent medical care here compared to many other states. I fully agree with that. However, states like Ohio, California, and Arizona have really come up with good medical plans. Mayo Clinic is in Arizona now. So I don't like to air my own personal matters here, but in terms of medical expense, I had medical expenses in 2003 over $600,000. And a little bit over a month ago, another $200,000. While most of that was the hospital and the clinic was covered by medical insurance, there are abnormal outside expenses which are not deductible, which a person like that has to come by with. And remember I said 3.3% is all we are getting on the average over the last 20 years from our COLAs. And it's really starting hurting us that are in our 70s now. We just can't keep up. I mean, my school district has, in the last 3 years, proposed two referendums, of which I've been hit, and I haven't had kids in school for many, many, many years. So that is elevating my property taxes, and my COLA is just not keeping up with it. And this is the kind of thing most of us seniors are faced with. Thank you.
Good.
One of the things I failed to mention in my discussion was people are putting pencil to the paper. If you talk to somebody that's ready to retire, you better believe they sit down and figure out. And if they can save $1,000 or $2,000 a year for life, they'll move. They are doing that. They put their pencil to the paper and find out exactly what it's going to cost them to retire where they retire. We know that. The other thing is that the bill. Thank you. contribution. Whatever. They have a lot of expertise in rules and absolutes. They go elsewhere and they contribute there. So that's a significant contribution in terms of employees. I work for the Forest Service and we had something like 500,000 person years of volunteerism.
It's interesting you bring volunteers up because we've had bills introduced this year that provide income tax credits for people for doing volunteer work because they want to have reduced their tax liability because they do volunteer work in communities. So the scope is pretty broad when it comes to income taxes. Senator Ortman.
Just wanted to make a point. You talk about the contributions that you're all making now as volunteers, but I think the one of the best arguments for supporting a position like this is the fact excuse me, that the folks sitting at this table and the folks that have earned these pensions built the community we live in. And their income now is suffering as a result of inflation. Every dollar that they earned now gets depleted by the circumstance of inflation. So their savings goes down. The dollar that they earned 20 years ago isn't worth hardly anything anymore. And we have to remember that what they put away for savings and for their pension now just continues to diminish in value. And they built the infrastructure that we live in. They built the roads. They built the schools. They built the community centers. And I think we should recognize their contribution. I think our society does a really poor job of recognizing the aging population and valuing what they did to provide all the resources that we have available to us today. And that would make, I think, one of the best reasons for supporting Senator Johnson's bill.
Senator Ortman, $67.5 million in 2009.
I got a bigger one than that coming up on the agenda today.
$155 million in 10 and 11. Senator Ortman, if we pass this, this money's in competition with money for schools, money for health care, with money for property tax relief. This money's in competition with everything else that we do. Senator Ortman, would you support an income tax increase to offset this, to make it, you know, on the work people that are working to help pay for this so that, because I don't think the individuals here want us to take money away from schools or from our nursing homes in the state or increase college tuition to help pay for this. So, Senator Ortman, would you support an income tax increase to help pay for this so we don't have to take money away from other things?
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I think what's really our biggest problem is the prioritization of how we spend our money. I think you'd almost have to redo the whole system. And like you say, we keep trying to find safety valves. We keep trying to do tax credits. And I don't think that we have a very straightforward system of taxation. And so some people might call them loopholes or something like that. Other people are trying to find ways to avoid taxation. And people come to the committee and say, we need to avoid the taxes that we're paying. And I think that if we had a more straightforward method of taxing people without all the exceptions and the loopholes or whatever you might call them, I think that we could actually reprioritize not just the way we raise the money but also the way we spend the money. And I think that it takes more than one person, more than one committee, to commit to doing that, but I think that's what's truly needed. But it doesn't diminish the fact that we keep trying to stop up the holes. We got a system that's leaking all over, and we keep trying to fix a hole there and fix a hole there, and we pop another hole, and the seniors pay too much in property taxes, and we pop in another cork over here, and something else spouts out, and we got a system that we're trying to keep together instead of maybe trying to drop the whole thing and build a new one. And maybe we could function with the system we've got now if there were really long-term commitment to building a new system on the side here, trying to fashion it and work it out so that we could all at some point move to the next building or the next infrastructure.
Senator Ortman, we had that discussion before you got here this morning about all the bills we've seen on sales tax exemptions, on income tax credits, and
And maybe we should have council just go through our statutes, and on that end of the table we'll stack up all the sales tax exemptions we have in law, and over there on that end we'll stack up all the income tax credits and exemptions we have, and the tax committee can maybe spend the summer, maybe we throw it all away, we throw it all away and say this whole piecemeal system we have, nobody really understands why, and maybe we just start over. Senator Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to work on that work group. I want to be on that work group.
Sure.
Senator Johnson, I think we're going to have a work group like that on the sales tax coming up before very long.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman.
Following what you just said, it would be an interesting subject area to say, look at our budget from 2000 and look at the 2008-2009 budget that we will adopt. And then go back and ask ourselves the question, what would have been the fairest way to raise the money to pay for this budget? Assuming that these were all valid needs and all the priorities for the state, what would have been the fairest way? And then go back and maybe learn from that. It would be a good subject.
I think we kind of started down the road on that discussion when we had the tax incident study and found out that our tax system in Minnesota not only is regressive, but is getting more regressive. And I think most of us here don't want it to get more regressive than it is, and I think it is a good discussion for this committee to have. Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, earlier in the discussion you had asked, should this type of exemption be used for a particular classification of retirees? And I think it's a good discussion to have in public policy as we think about it, because just in the last probably – well, this morning we're going to talk of exactly the same thing for other issues. Now, we had Senator Olson here talking about a sales tax exemption on repair and replacement parts and tires for one industry, the logging industry. And Senator Kubley has one on farm machinery sales tax exemptions. And another one by Senator Kubley is on sales tax exemption for loop field collection systems for heat pumps. Now, these are private businesses all coming here asking for an exemption in the parts they use to create the product that they're going to sell. But we're isolating their business and their product to get the special golden sales tax exemption. But we could also ask the same question, is it fair to all the other productive companies in the state of Minnesota? Maybe we should wipe out all their sales tax exemptions, and we could probably take about 40% of our workload off our backs in this committee if we just did that. So I think sometimes we try to make an argument that a particular industry is more important than others. Farmers will come in, we feed the world, and logging, we house the world, and we create the raw products, and we get them out of the woods, and everyone's going to have their pitch to make to say how virtuous they are, more virtuous than other products. And so we do have to raise that question. It's a part of the public policy that we have to have, but we have it every day. And so,
Senator Limmer, I think if it's not too big a task that can't be done over the course of the summer, I think we have all asked Senate Council to put a list together for us of all the kind of income tax credits we have on one side and all the sales tax exemptions we have on the other, and we'll put them out on the table. And I got a feeling it will be a boom for the lobbying industry because a whole lot of lobbyists are going to get employed trying to preserve all those little niches in law that we've put in over the years. But it is a good discussion for this committee to have because we have a very piecemeal tax system, and every year we add a few more little pieces where we exempt a few and do a few more credits, and it's a good discussion for us to have.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Quite a long time ago, there was a group set up in Clay County, my county, because they felt the property tax system was way too complicated. So they studied it for a while. They came back with the idea, it's very complicated, but it needs to be complicated to be fair. They didn't recommend any changes. Well, then, you know, when Jesse Ventura was governor, he had this very unique thing. He picked people out of the phone book. and had them sit down, and one day they went over the whole tax system in Minnesota, and then the next day they come out with recommendations, and what they said was, it's pretty good the way it is. Didn't recommend much. So there's a reason behind all this. Now, I know when we do these things piecemeal, we probably don't quite understand what we're doing, and I think we should take a look at that. But just generally speaking, I think it's pretty close to where it should be. We should, I think, constantly be looking at it and reviewing it and so on and probably making some changes. But I think it's pretty good. You know, when I was running for re-election this fall, I think it was Senator Scoy's opponent that wanted to eliminate property taxes for people over 65. Well, I suppose I could have jumped up and cheered because I was the only one there over 65. But I said, I paid my taxes. I'll pay them along with everybody else. I think they're too high for everybody, but let's lower them for everybody. But I don't see why I should get less because of my age. I mean, I'm probably better off today than I was 20 years ago, you know.
Senator Johnson, I think we have to move on. We've got a number of additional bills on the agenda for today. Thank you all for coming in. This is a good discussion for the committee to have, and these discussions only take place when we have a bill in front of us, so we'll go down the road together.
Mr. Chair.
Chair lays over Senate File 705 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 2008 establishes a housing revitalization TIF district, and it allows that the increments may be spent only for the costs of a home rehabilitation program, a substandard home replacement program, and a downtown dump remediation. And there are several exceptions to the general TIF provisions that would be allowed for this district. With me is members of the Columbia Heights City staff to talk about this proposal. Basically, we are on the topic of inner ring suburban redevelopment issues and the challenges that we face with older housing stock, but a middle to lower income tax base and very little downtown commercial, if any, commercial development that, as opposed to a Minneapolis, that can help subsidize greater economic development. So this is kind of the catch-22 that inner ring suburbs are kind of perpetually caught in, and so this is what we're seeking to do with this TIF plan. So which one would you like to go ahead?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Bob Streeter with the City of Columbia Heights, and to add to what the Senator was saying, the City of Columbia Heights is just north of Minneapolis, and if you go across the bridge, you're in North Minneapolis, and we have a lot of the same issues and problems with our housing stock that they're experiencing, not to the degree, we're smaller, but we have a lot of the same demographics, the same age of housing. And what the City Council is trying to do is maintain and preserve the quality of their housing stock, number one. And number two, we've got a four-acre dump in our downtown at 40th and Central that's been there for probably since the 40s and 50s that we need to clean up. And so what they want to do is three things. They want to establish a home replacement program, a rehab program, and they want to clean up the dump. And to give you a bit of background on Columbia Heights, this has been the housing problems in Columbia Heights have been an issue for residents since the early 90s. The housing in Columbia Heights is very old. The median age for a structure built is 1957. In the metropolitan area, it's 1971. Out of 175 taxing jurisdictions in the metropolitan area, only two have a lower estimated market value for a single-family home. and residential is 90% of our tax base. We've surveyed our properties, and at least 200 had moderate or severe code deficiencies, with 75 that could be candidates for demolition. Our fire department tells us that many of our single-family homes and duplexes are being converted to rental because the cost to make them marketable as owner-occupied is prohibitive. One of the challenges that makes it difficult for residents and householders in Columbia Heights to improve their home is their household income is three-quarters of the metropolitan median. In fact, out of 189 taxing jurisdictions, only 9 have a lower household income than Columbia Heights, and one of those is the city of Hilltop, which is an 80-acre city within Columbia Heights. It's largely a mobile home park. So what the council wants to do is establish a home replacement program. We'd partner with a nonprofit. They would go out and acquire the home voluntarily. They would tear it down. They'd relocate the residents, and we build a new home in its place. And the funds that we need from this tax increment district would pay for acquisition, demolition, and relocation. And tentatively, we'd like to do 5 homes a year or 125 homes a year or 125 over 25 years. The second thing we'd like to do is establish a home rehab program for those homes that aren't necessarily candidates for demolition. We want to preserve them, and we would provide grants and loans for households who have an income of $90,000 or less. That's 115% of the area median income, and we'd like to do 5 of those a year or 125 over 25 years. And then lastly, we have a dump in downtown Columbia Heights. It's going to be $3.5 to $4 million to clean up. And there aren't the state resources or the resources from the Med Council or the city resources to pay for that. The council has a plan in front of them. They haven't approved it because they don't know if they can clean the property, but it's contemplating 60 units of senior rental housing and about 15,000 square feet of office commercial. And so if we want to see that redevelopment to occur, we need to clean up the dump. So with that, the city council is asking your support, your permission, to extend the term of this tax increment financing district to generate the revenues to replace housing, to rehab housing, and clean up a dump. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, also a historical reference. If you recall, this was when we were having the eminent domain discussion in Columbia Heights and the TIF. This includes that area that we were talking about, and so this would help us do all that development without eminent domain.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, are you making any exceptions to the eminent domain reform that we made a year ago?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, no. This is strictly TIF. The only what was. But that's what we were – the only thing I was saying is that's what we were thinking of and didn't do with Columbia Heights in that eminent domain discussion we had. And so now, we're back looking for help to be able to pool our own money to clean up, buy out, all of that. So, no, this does makes no changes to eminent domain.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, back when we – made those reforms to eminent domain, we were fearful that a city might be encouraged by a developer to take out a present property owner who may have had a property that in some people's minds wouldn't be up to the full and best use of that particular land. And then the city would quickly sell or pass over that land to the new developer. And it was all kind of a very hushed discussion, at least in other examples. And sometimes people's homes were taken. I can think of the Richfield incidents of the Best Buy purchase and the definitions of blight that were used and other references were at least questionable. And we don't have any of this. That type of thing going on in here, so I just want to be cautious because I really don't want to do a lot of damage to the reforms we did, and we were told that there'd be a tidal wave of exceptions coming to the legislature to recognize at least one more exception to that eminent domain, and we'd be right back where we were before. But it appears as though your assurances are telling us that that's not anywhere close to what that is.
Senator Limmer, those were my concerns too, so I would not be bringing back an exception.
Senator Chaudhry, we have an A1 amendment that the city attorney has requested. How do you feel about that?
Fine.
It gives the city some additional flexibility.
Actually, I think this is just really clarifying what's already in the bill. It doesn't make any.
So you're fine with it?
Yeah.
Senator Limmer moves the A1 amendment. Members. Council, explain what the A1 does for us.
Mr. Chairman, members, the amendment would clarify a provision that's in the bill that had prohibited certain uses for the area within the downtown dump remediation area from being authorized to be placed in that area. This amendment would just clarify that the intent is that tax increments can't be expended on any project that would include these otherwise prohibited uses within that area. So it doesn't remove them from the area, but it says you can't spend tax increments for those purposes.
Senator Chaudhry, you're fine with that? Any discussion on the A1? Anybody want to testify on A1? On the A1 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1's adopted. Any other discussion from the committee? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, do you know, does the city of Columbia Heights receive local government aid?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, yes. And I can, do you know how much?
We have seen a reduction of $1.4 million in local government aid in the last 5 years. I think this year, I think we received about $1.2 million, Senator.
Mr. Chair, so then the city will receive approximately over $2 million each biennium.
Senator, I think that would be right.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, the point for me is, I guess I have a follow-up question, which would be, how much of a loss of city revenue will you have as a result of the TIF districts that you're approving here today? Is it a significant portion of your budget or just a small portion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, our fiscal advisor estimated that if this district were allowed to decertify, that there would be no change, there would be no additional revenue to the school district, and that the city and county together would see their taxes reduced on an average value home by between $15 and $20 a year. And that we weren't really sure because the rules always change, but as the rules exist today, that's the closest they could estimate.
Senator Ortman.
So I'm following you saying it's about $15 per homeowner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, if the average value home is $168,931, and that home would potentially see a reduction of about $15 to $20 a year if this were allowed to decertify or was not allowed to extend.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ortman.
I'm trying to make the point that there's always a connection here between what we do, and this means less property tax relief with our LGA payments to your homeowners, and I just want to draw the connection. It seems to me that if you're doing revitalization, you're not taking an awful lot of high-end properties off of the tax rolls. You're taking off property values that aren't generating revenues and trying to restore them, rehab them, and make them better properties that do generate more tax revenue. And I think this is a good project. I'm hoping that the committee will work, maybe start to focus in a little bit on these TIF districts and say, what are we doing to the property owners that do pay when you take more properties off of the tax rolls locally, because there's always an impact to the homeowners that are paying for the local property taxes. And so, Senator Chaudhry, I think this, as you said, if it doesn't change it doesn't expand the time frame here, it expands districts, but it doesn't expand the time frame, so it's not impacting eminent domain. And what's happened there, then I think this seems like a good proposal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, just to add to that, this is an extension of a current TIF district. So in reality, the change to other taxpayers outside of the district is nil.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
It doesn't change the rights of anyone.
Oh, no.
When it comes to the taking of a piece of property, the rights that we extended to them last year with eminent domain still will apply, and this will not extend them back into that old group. They'll still be in the new group of homeowners who get all the rights that we assume that they get by passing the eminent domain bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, this is a financing tool, not a property acquisition tool, so you are correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the committee? Yep. Senator Sendrum.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Chaudhry, and to your witness, I think it's a good thing. I know in my hometown we've done about 800 houses with programs like this now, and I don't know if this is about attacking blight and things like that, but if you don't attack blight, we all know what comes afterwards, and that's a whole lot of additional city expense and concerns and so on and so forth. So I congratulate. The one question I do have, and I know that we've done this in Rochester, to try to keep the equity, if you will, within the TIF and the public expenditure scheme of things, we have on these properties put the land, if you will, into a conservator, or what do you call it, conservation easement, I think it is. And so then as people move through the houses, they don't necessarily take all the equity with them. It's there for others. And, of course, the cost then stays a little lower. So it works pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from the committee? If not, Chair lays over Senate file 2008 as amended. Senator Chaudhry, one more bill you got.
Senate file 1872, and I've got an author's amendment.
I just caused. Senate file 1872 is in front of the committee.
Yeah. This will get it into the shape that I desire, Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson moves the A1 amendment.
Eliminates the possibility to spend for the transit station.
Yeah. Council, tell us what the A1 amendment does.
Mr. Chair, members, excuse me, the A1 amendment to Senate File 1872 deletes the language that permits expenditures of tax increments under this new district for the development or expanded use of the transfer station.
Senator Chaudhry, is that what you want to do with the amendment? Any questions from the committee? On the A1 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Senator Chaudhry, on your bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, we've got the commuter rail project, North Star Corridor project, going through the Northwest Corridor, so to speak, and part of that is the city of Fridley. And this bill would allow the city of Fridley to use the TIF district, call this Fridley Station site or Fridley Station district is what we're calling it, for infrastructure and development surrounding the station. We've got maps that we can hand out to members on the size of that site or that size of the district. But whenever you get one of these stations, you've got an enormous amount of change, economic change surrounding that. So this would help the city of Fridley with infrastructure costs related to the geographical area surrounding that proposed site. We do have a, I do want to put in a small amendment to the bill that would allow for additional infrastructure that is perhaps not covered by the bill as we just amended it. But in general, what I want to do with this is to allow the city of Fridley to deal with the infrastructure and development surrounding that station, but not the station itself. The station itself is part of that North Star Corridor project.
We excluded that with the amendment.
Correct.
Any questions, members?
She's coming up with something.
I see that. And Senator Shotrape, we're allowing the city to take increment from three other districts also for this district?
Yes.
Can we speak to that?
Mr. Chairman, I am Jim Casserly, law firm of Crass Monroe, and we assist the city with its development programs. Yes, there are three districts which do have some revenues and resources that we'd like to incorporate into this new district if the committee allows. Those districts right now would provide total current and future of $2.4 million. Currently, there's a balance of $700,000 in those districts, which we could utilize for various kinds of project expenses. And in the future, there would be approximately $1.7 million. So it would be a total of $2.4 million that would be allowed by this amendment or by the bill.
Questions, members? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question on this handout. It says that the property on the east and west sides of the BNSF tracks were used as an informal dump for construction debris. Is that used by, did the railroad dump stuff there? Or, and if they did, can't they be called on to clean up that stuff they left there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm Scott Hickok, Community Development Director for the City of Fridley. And, Senator, we're not quite certain the origin. We have done a little bit of historic research on the elements that are there and how and why they got to be there. But we discovered this back at a time where we were doing an analysis on the property to validate its worthiness and to see what would need to be done in order to have it as part of the station site. We did some early looking and discovered that it might have been even from back at the time a farm was there or something. Materials, it appears, were dumped and covered over on the property. And we do anticipate that as part of that station site development, that kind of cleanup will have to take place to remove debris, subsurface debris, and to bring the soils back to what are necessary for parking and other landscape features.
Mr. Chair, so it's safe to say that it probably wasn't from the railroad?
Yes, Senator, I believe that's safe to say, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, members?
Mr. Chair, there was I'd spoken with Ms. Zoff about that tunnel issue. Can you suggest some language for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, I can work on that for by the next time the bill surfaces. Right. We can talk with the local people. And
all right. Sounds good.
Any other questions, members?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like a moment just to address the committee on my desire for this station site in Fridley. Okay. I'm the mayor of Fridley, and I am very supportive of
name for the record, please.
Scott Lund. And I'm very supportive of the North Star Rail station site and in hopes that we will get one in Fridley, although it has been currently taken out of the mix because of the costs. It's taken a while to get to this point, and in the interim, I think the inflation has eaten away at a lot of the funding, so Fridley was taken out of that mix. In looking at this situation, we felt it important to be proactive, and that's why we've come up with pooling the districts, if we're allowed to do that by legislative action, and in helping the station site occur through use of our tax increment district, creation of the tax increment district, we could, as a one of the major costs is a tunnel. Because of the uniqueness of the Fridley Station site, the proposed station site, and why we've suggested this tunnel to Senator Chaudhry, the tunnel would be an excellent thing for an east-west connection for us. The rail tracks go north and south. The proposed station is to be built between the two tracks, so there would be a separation, and a tunnel is needed for safety, of course, to access not only the station, if it is ultimately built, which we sincerely hope, but also as an east-west connection. We have immediately across from that rail site, we have an elementary school. There is no access. Illegally, people traverse across the rail tracks all the time. We definitely need a connection. Although this tunnel would be a walkway, bikeway connection, it would be very, even as a standalone project, I think that with the utilization of some TIF money or pooling that, we can accomplish and aid the North Star Rail Station. Just in that alone is a significant improvement for that area and an enhancement to an eventual station. So besides that, we could use the monies for the infrastructure of the streets that would have to be makeshift, changed to help in that east-west connection. Right now, either you'd travel on 694, a major interstate, or you go all the way up to Mississippi, which is three-quarters of a mile, so there is no east-west connection. I think it's very vital for us because we are our community is separated by that by those train the train tracks. And, again, we want to help, and we think this is a very proactive measure, and I hope that you senators will see that as well as a proaction for Fridley to assist. Thank you.
Anything else, members? Senator Squay.
Mr. Chair, Mayor Lund, did I hear you say that this site is not scheduled to be a transit stop currently?
As it is now, it has been taken out of the mix because of the costs and not enough funding with the NCDA. They'd still like to have it. North Star is in favor of it still. The authority is in favor. That there's been other issues in other committee hearings about trying to get that back into the mix, but it all comes back, as I hear today again, it's always about money, isn't it? But we're trying to help that along with this addition of a TIF district for $2.4 million. If we can aid them, that's just lessens the cost.
Thank you.
Anything else, members? If not, Chair lays over Senate File 1872 as amended. Thank you, Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank
members.
You, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Committee.
What's your vote? Senate File 2003. Members, this is a modification of levy authority for the Cook Orr Hospital District, a district that was put into law by former tax chair Senator Johnson. Mr. Volt, welcome to the floor. Tell us about the Cook Orr Hospital District, the unique nature of it.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you very much. My name is Al Vogt. I'm the administrator of the Cook Hospital in Cook, Minnesota. We're a 14-bed hospital, 41-bed nursing home. And back in 1988, former Senator Johnson assisted our region by introducing legislation that formed the Cook Orr Healthcare District. We cover about 2,500 square miles in northeastern Minnesota, and although it's relatively sparsely populated, particularly during summer months with all the tourism and such, we have a very active hospital and nursing home and emergency room. During the formation of the district, Senator Johnson had introduced special legislation that created the ability to levy based upon a 2-mil cap used for capital expenditures and capital equipment only. It was a wonderful way for us to give representation to the folks within the district. Prior to that, we were a city-owned hospital, And this gave a good broad representation to all the towns and townships surrounding the hospital and those folks who use the district, use the facility. What is being proposed here right now, as you know, that most small rural hospitals and healthcare organizations are financially stressed, particularly in long-term care, but it's certainly hospitals as well, and the ability to have the flexibility that most of the hospital districts in Minnesota currently have under that have been formed under the general hospital district laws is something that would allow for us to be able to assist the folks of the region to maintain a healthcare organization facility, to use it as major needs come up, and it becomes a highly valuable ability for us to be able to access a variety of sources of funding dollars as we need them. And I appreciate the committee's and Senator Bach your support in this process for us.
So, members, what this does is, because this is a special taxing district, a large rural area, what this does is gives them the same levy authority as other hospitals just under general taxing levy authority does. But they don't currently have that because they're a special district.
Correct.
Any questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Vogt. Chair lays over Senate file 2003 for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Pearson? Nurse, go ahead.
While she's coming up, I was, you know, it'd be easier for you if you just had the Cook County or hospital.
Senator Squire, they're about 3 hours apart.
Oh, they're ways apart. Huh?
Members, Senate file 2028 is something similar situation up in Cook County where we have a county-wide hospital district. Ms. Pearson, your name for the record and who you represent.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Diane Pearson. I am the administrator of the Cook County North Shore Hospital and Care Center in Grand Marais. I am here today on behalf of the Cook County Hospital District Board requesting your support for Senate File 2028, which removes the limit from our district's tax levy. The board is requesting this special legislation because the existing levy is not sufficient. As Mr. Vogt pointed out, our hospital district, similar to that in Cook, continues to see substantial losses in our nursing home, and these losses can no longer be offset by hospital operations or by our existing levy. The existing levy is capped by special legislation that was adopted in 2003. Under this cap, our current levy is $337,653. The Cook County Board has passed a resolution supporting our request, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me time this morning.
Members, what's happening here is we have had in law a 1% countywide sales tax to support capital improvements at the North Shore Hospital in Grand Marais, because they simply couldn't maintain a hospital there and pay for the capital improvements in a small county with, you know, the big flux of tourists that we have on the North Shore in the tourist season. That 1% tax has been very effective in making improvements at the hospital and at the nursing home, and so effective that it actually is going to expire around the end of this year. The bonds will be paid off for the improvements that have been made there. So we're going to ask the hospital to kind of fly it on their own and not have a local sales tax anymore for any of their improvements. So what this does is just puts them under the same levy authority that other under general hospital levies. Again, they don't have this because they're a special taxing district countywide. Any questions, members? If not, Chair lays over Senate file 2028 for possible inclusion. Ms. Pearson, you came the furthest today. How many miles is it to the hospital
from
here?
It's about 280 miles.
Thank you for coming down.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Senator Pogemiller?
It's like Boston and Washington.
That's what my drive is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2054 is a bill that sets the budget reserve for this go-around. First, I'd like to put the A1 amendment on. It's a technical amendment that the Senate Council has suggested. I would offer the A1.
Members have it. Technical amendment, I believe. Senator Pogue-Miller moves to A1. Discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Senator Pogue-Miller, why is this a good idea?
Mr. Chairman, members, the State's Council of Economic Advisors has repeatedly over the years recommended that the reserve be increased to 5% of biennial spending. In the February forecast this year, they again noted that they believed it would be prudent to get our reserve up to that amount. And as you know, the forecast indicated that there was perhaps some softening of the economy, and we need to be careful here. Nationally, the Government Finance Officers Association also recommends reserves being at that 5% level. The current reserves that we have are cash flow account of $350 million and a reserve of $653 for a total of $1 billion. This bill would add $629 million to that, which would get us up to the 5%. That would be a $1.6 billion reserve. And keep in mind that this is one-time money, and so the idea here is to make sure that we have enough set aside so that when the inevitable downturn in the economy comes, which it is inevitable, that we have some cushion to protect us against doing all kinds of budget gimmicks and other activities to avoid either cuts or tax increases to the best extent possible. Now, 1.6 seems like a lot of money, but if you look at the sheet that was handed out, you will note that in 1999, we had 4.7 set aside, and we all know what happened as we went into the downturn. In addition to that $972 million that was set aside, we went through a billion-dollar tobacco endowment, which is not indicated here, and we still had significant problems in terms of just trying to keep the wheels from falling off. And so I really don't think the 1.6 of one-time money is that much money when you consider what the challenge is going to be when this inevitable downturn comes. And the choice is really simple. We either spend the money or we set it aside. And I think the fiscally prudent thing to do in the first year of a four-year term is for the Senate to set it aside, or to suggest to both the House and the governor that we set it aside, rather than do short-term, one-time spending with it that will put us in a position to be really behind the eight ball. And I really think this is the prudent thing to do. In some respects, I think it's our responsibility to do it as the Senate. And I hope we could encourage both the House and the governor to do this also. And this would bring us to, this number would actually bring us to 5.1% under the forecasted spending. But if you then take the Senate's budget targets, it gets us to about between 4.9 and 5.0. So it's pretty close, even under what we're projecting to spend in the Senate. And it also has a provision that captures the interest on that amount of money as long as it's sitting there, and that would get us in 10 and 11 an additional $70 million. If it's still there, we may have had to use it by then, by 10 or 11. I think the odds are that we will have had to use some of it by that time. But I think this would be a prudent thing to do. And so I hope members would be supportive. And as I mentioned on the Senate floor yesterday, there's opposing views on this set aside, mostly from members of the Finance Committee. And I think you can imagine why that would be. There's a long list of items that they are being asked to fund on a one-time basis. And Senator Bach and Senator and I felt that perhaps, since this is in the purview of the Tax Committee, that perhaps it would be a prudent thing to do to just put a stake in the ground and say, this is what we think we should do this year. So I want to be clear to members, there is some tension around this. I think this is the Tax Committee's responsibility, and I think we should accept it and do it.
Senator Borgerman, we might have a tough sell on the Senate floor with this. I mean, we are, Tax Committee's taking the position with this, that of the one-time money that exists, the people that, the public and the press are calling surpluses, that the position of the Tax Committee will be that about over 62% of that one-time surplus money would be put into the reserve to be available in the event of a future budget crisis.
And that does leave $380 million that will be spent. So it's not like there's not going to be money available to be spent. And I know, we've all been listening to our colleagues on the finance side. And
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pogemiller, I know we're trying to take advantage of the surplus in order to build a reserve so that we don't take it out of ongoing allotment of funds that would go into services and other state responsibilities. Do you know if there's any projection long-term beyond biennium, if there may be another projection coming, or is that too far out to even expect? Thinking that maybe we could do it in a payment plan where we build a reserve a little over time based on a future surplus.
Mr. Chairman, what we know for certain, and Mr. Simpson says this every time he gives us a budget forecast, we know it's coming. It is a question of when it's coming. And I think the 1990s was unusual that we had about a 7 or 8 year run where we did not run into trouble. But that was unusual. Mm-hmm. Typically, it's a 4 or 5 year cycle. And we are, whatever your calculation might be, we're in the second or third or fourth year of that cycle right now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller.
But no one knows for sure.
Yeah, Mr. Pogemiller, or Senator Pogemiller, funny thing happened during the Ventura administration. Remember, we kind of
multiple funny things happened.
withdrew from from a revenue source for the state. We're now, as a result of that, we now rely on our revenues based more on economic production of the economy. The economy's good, we fill our coffers. If the economy's poor, we don't, and that could trigger an ongoing series of deficits off and on in our future. Sometimes these economic downturns can happen quickly. Take, for example, the unforeseen example of 9/11 and the impact on the state and national economies, and we suddenly rushed headlong into a series of deficits. We also have a very productive, competitive world out there that's now, as a result, it triggers expenses in fuel and gasoline. Look at the influence of China on just the world fuel market and how it can trigger that added demand, can trigger the cost of fuel, which can be reflected in our state budgets. If the cost of fuel suddenly goes up high, we've got a problem. So I recognize the need to have a larger reserve. I'm just wondering if we couldn't stagger this payment out over a little time rather than one big lump and make it a little easier on our finance people, too.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogomar.
Well, the choice is, to me, that's kind of a, that presumes the revenue is going to keep coming in. Then you can set it aside over a period of time. What if we're at a period where the revenues aren't going to keep coming in? Then you're not going to replenish.
Do it over 2 years.
And I think based on the February forecast, there is some cause for concern here. And the secondary mortgage market, we're at war. I just think, the Senate institutionally has four-year terms for a reason, to try to think a little longer term. And I think it could be to everybody's benefit, regardless of political affiliation, to try to be a little conservative here in terms of set aside. This is something the Council of Economic Advisors recommends, that we be at that amount. And keep in mind, if you look at this chart, that even when we were close to that in 99, 4.7, we went through that and a tobacco endowment. And still, we were in pretty, I mean, that was not a fun 3 or 4 years for any of us. So I don't think trying to incrementally get back is the smart thing to do. I think the smart thing to do is take this while this money's sitting here. Because the choice is real simple. We either set it aside or we spend it.
Because
if it's available, is there any doubt in this room? If it's available, it will be spent.
Senator Limmer, Senator Pogomar and I started talking about this early in the session, and not much was made of the February forecast by the media when it came out. Status quo, I think, is what most of the newspaper reports are, but those of us in this room know that the February forecast showed a $418 million reduction in 10 and 11. That's troubling. That somehow between November and February, that forecast for the next biennium has changed by over $400 million. So that really, I think, really perked our interest in the discussions with Senator Cohen about, I would rather do something like this than be in a situation 2 years from now, maybe next year, don't know, of having to use different accounting gimmicks like the accelerated sales tax, the June accelerated payment. It's not fair to our business community to do that to them.
School aid shifts
that are punitive to our school districts. They have to go out and borrow money in order to get by. We just don't have a lot of options in the event we come back here this time next year and our revenues are continuing to slip. I mean, this may be the money that would be available, so we don't have to do other kind of accounting gimmicks next year just to get through the current biennium. We just don't know. So I think it is safer for us to put this away because the February forecast clearly showed that there is some instability in our revenue in the future. Senator Limmer?
On the same token, Mr. Chair and Senator Pogomiller, if we try to grow our piggy bank, keep our reserve strong and larger in anticipation of some type of fiscal calamity that could cause a serious deficit.
Well, doesn't
state.
Have to be a calamity.
True.
It's just a normal downturn in the economy. This does not have to be a calamity.
But if we're anticipating at the years 10 and 11 out that may be a little weaker in revenue, we should also warn ourselves that we should be a little more prudent in the increase in spending that we now are thinking about this year. Some of our budgets are getting rather large and growing rather fast in some of the things that we've seen, at least our side of the legislature, introduce. So we have to be a little prudent on the spending side, too.
Well, the first two bills that have passed appeared fairly prudent.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what else is coming. Senator Murphy's bill that we're going to take up today is prudent in the sense that at least he raises revenue to spend it. I mean, you have to grant him that. He's raising the revenue to spend it. He's not just spending it.
Senator Limmer, if we're going to save this money, this is the committee that has to do it, because I think we all saw yesterday one of those finance bills passed 64-2 and the other passed 66-0. And I suspect next week when we have all the regular, the rest of the regular budget committees up, they'll pass with overwhelming numbers. But this is the hard work, because we could easily add this money to the finance bills and I think we'd see the same kind of numbers, 66-0, 64-2. But, and I'm not even sure we get this before this is going to pass. But I think this committee has some responsibility to provide some leadership to the rest of the Senate, because this is where the hard work is done.
Let me be real blunt. Senator Bach and I have both been told personally that there are certain things, if we do this, there will be certain things that we personally want that will not be in the finance bill. That's life. That's reality.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, I agree with just about everything you said. I think this should be a priority. I think if we don't set it aside, we won't have a set aside, because we know how to spend money around here. And I do agree with you, Senator Bach, that the members of this committee should stand firm about this and be the strongest opponents of this conservative approach here. But I also have to add one piece here, with all due respect, Senator Pogemiller, and that's that if we're gonna set this money aside, we don't want to do it on the backs of the taxpayers. If we're going to raise taxes elsewhere, that will hurt the economy almost as much as if we didn't set this money aside. We're going to ask taxpayers to pay probably $1,000 more a year in that transportation bill if we pass it. And that will hurt the economy. It can't continue to bear the burden here. And I think in addition to what Senator Limmer has said, that we have to curtail our spending, we also can't just save the $629 million at the expense of the taxpayers and turn around and tax them that same amount just so we can save it at the state level. The biggest problem I think that we have with our budget and tax system right now is sustainability. We keep adding programs, we keep spending, and somehow that money has to come from the taxpayers, and there's only so much. And so if we set aside $629 million, which I do support, we're asking the taxpayers to pay it, and they won't have it in their savings account. They won't have it to pay for tuition at for college. They won't have it to pay for extra sales tax. They won't have it to pay for other things that we will want to tax. And they won't have it for investing in new jobs or new businesses. And so we have to recognize that there's an expense here. And so I agree that if we have the one-time money, it should be spent this way. But I think the same members of the tax committee that would be supporters of that should also be very careful before they support new taxes on taxpayers in the state of Minnesota who can no longer continue to sustain the growing spending trends that we've adopted in the state of Minnesota.
Well, Senator Ortman, we do need to remember that much of the spending that's going to be done in this committee are going to be tax expenditures. We've certainly seen plenty of those bills file through here.
I haven't forgotten. I've got a big one myself.
This committee spends money too. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. I want to support what Senator Pogemiller and Senator Bach are doing.
Senator
Senjum. I think 5% is a little ambitious. So I think that there will be some discussion around that. But I think we need this as part of the mix in the conversation as we're spending this year. I think this is important.
Senator Sendra.
Well, and Mr. Chair, and I would just identify with those comments. That's frankly why I signed on. It seems like as we arrived here and as we spent the last couple of months, so we've been in the face of a spending Katrina, so to speak, and it's going pretty hard and it's going pretty fast, and the notion, I think we need to throw this thing out there to maybe slow people down and people need to think a little bit about this. And I, for one, I guess Senator Ortman as well, came to this place when 2003 we were looking at a 0.4% reserve. That wasn't fun. And we had no place to look. And under any rock that we looked, there was not money. And so you think about maybe government operating like a business. I think most good businesses would expect someplace around 4 or 5% in terms of reserve, maybe even 6. So I think this is reasonable, and I think we ought to put it out there and have the debate. One thing I did have, and I don't know if Senator Pogemiller can answer this question or not, If you go back to those 2003, 2004 years, there was a lot of discussion about our bond rating and where that was, and that our state was generally kind of unstable at that point from the standpoint of bond assurances. This, I think, taking it up to 5% might take us back to a full-fledged AAA across the board, I would believe, or
that
at least
be
position
hope, yes.
us well.
I think it would, because we slipped on one of them.
No.
So that would be a good thing, yes.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could probably give the same speech that were just given by the previous two speakers. I think this is smart. I'm not sure that I'm signed up for the full $62 million or $629 million bucks or not. So I'll reserve this.
Slippery
but I want to get this, I
wanna
get this out in front of the full Senate for a full-fledged discussion. You know, I was around in 2003 when we blasted through all of our, ended all the gimmicks, and, you know, it was just bad, really bad. And I really regret that we blasted through that $1 billion tobacco endowment. There's still a promise out there to repay it. I don't think it's going to happen, though, which I think is regrettable. My question is, you know, these forecasts, you know, in my experience, it seems like we kind of overestimate the highs and don't quite anticipate how low we're going to fall. There's been some real criticism on the methodology of the forecasts that we rely on. Is there anyone looking at how we reform that? Are other states doing it better than we are?
I think it's not science. It just isn't science. Very little changes in the economy have very large impacts on revenue.
But I understand that putting this money on the reserve, you know, helps us even out the highs and the lows a little bit. But you know, we can apply as much backward-looking science as possible and look at our trends and try to figure out how to control for it. If we do some discounting factors or techniques, so we're not relying and spending every dollar of forecasts or under-anticipating the deficits, so we don't get ourselves in this kind of messes that we
Chairman,
have relying on these forecasts.
I don't. We used to be considered as good as anybody in the nation in doing this, but I don't think we've looked at that for a few years, so perhaps that would be a good suggestion, and I think during the interim, I think we'll do some work on that.
Yeah. I'll sign up. So.
I think that's a good idea, to just see if we're where we need to be there. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate File 2054 as amended. We recommend to pass.
And sent to the Senate floor.
Yes.
Any other discussion members? Senator Johnson.
I want to comment on the Senate file number 2. I'm glad to see it's not an early one that you'd already predetermined. I'm glad to see that this came about as the session went on, and it's a fairly fresh Senate file number. I'm just glad that it's thoughtful.
Well, Senator Johnson, the temperature was really turned up after the February forecast and discussions between Senator Pogrom and myself.
Mr. Chair,
we don't quite have Senator Cohen on board yet. Senator Sundrum.
You know, as one still relatively new around here, one of the things that, and I don't always remember this number, but because I'm not a numbers guy, just necessarily should probably not even be in this committee, but you know, as you look at the November forecast in 2005, it was $181 million, and come 2006, then the same November, it was $1.035 billion. And it just struck me, and I don't know if that's a lot of volatility or not, but it's $1 billion, and those billion, they sway back and forth,
yes.
And so to have a little cushion, I think is a good thing, and again, that's why I signed on the bill.
Any other discussion, members? If not, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
And Senator Pogrom, we're going to have this on the floor when?
Maybe tomorrow.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I the last one?
That will be up to Senator Ortman.
Oh, okay, Mr. Chair.
Be quick. No.
I will make this very quick, Mr. Chair and members. I have before you Senate File 1204. It's a tax exemption for biomass burning stoves, which doesn't sound very glamorous, but there's tremendous amount of movement in that area. But if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an oral amendment, please.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen. You can't move an amendment. You're not a member of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I have an oral
amendment.
If you would
tell us what the oral amendment is, we'll have somebody on the committee move it for you.
Maybe this won't be quick.
Maybe other committees let members do that, but this committee doesn't allow that.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is the first time I've been in front of you. So,
Senator Rosen, I thought we had you in front of this committee last year on this kind of on this similar issue. But
Mr. Chair, I've been at this issue for at least 3 years. It started off as a tax exempt for corn burning stoves, expanded it to biomass stoves. I had Bob Walker, who is the creator of Select Comfort and now is in Bixby Energy Systems and creates these biomass burning stoves. And he's a little disillusioned in this whole process here. So he's in this magazine, this month's magazine of Twin Cities Monthly, huge article about these stoves. And I couldn't get him here today. He's actually on a business trip. So the testimony is going to be coming from me. But back to the amendment, Mr. Chair, if somebody could move removing Section 2, page 1, line 14, the whole section. And, Mr. Chair, I suppose the description, too, in the...
Mr. Chair, right. I would move that proposed amendment.
Mr. Chair, this amendment... changes because I adopted Senator Saxhog's language last year, and I thought I just assumed he wanted this language in here this year, and it's already
in law. On the Sendrum oral amendment, delete Section 2. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Rosen.
So, Mr. Chair, basically, the reason why I think this is a very important move this year is because obviously Minnesota is truly a leader in alternative energy. The rock star in alternative energy could not be here, and he could explain about how biomass burning stoves is really the whole competition and the competitive nature of this is really coming on, and people are starting to adopt this all across the nation. Up here, of course, we have corn and we have wood pellets and wood products that we can use in stoves. And you have to actually have different stoves for each product that you're using. If you're using olive pits or using cottonseed, or it's kind of fascinating. But I would suggest reading this article. But our whole push, and especially in the committee that I sit on and Senator Senjum with energy, is how we can affect our dependence on foreign oil and how we're heating our buildings and our homes and how we're taking care of basically our environment. And so I really hope that this is the year that we can get something done in this area, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rosen, did you have a turkey byproduct bill to some here?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I believe that was Senator Kubley.
Oh, thank you. You're right.
Yeah.
Anybody care what it costs? We're getting the fiscal note. It's at the copier right now. I don't know. We didn't get it into the packet for some reason, but maybe we didn't have it.
Mr. Chair, do you have the fiscal note?
Do you have it, Senator Rosen?
I do. Mr. Chair, in 08 and 09. 08 is what, a million, and 09 is 1.2. And in 2010 is 1.4, and 2011 is 1.6. But I do personally know of quite a few people that have fueled their homes, have made that investment. And it is an amazing component of heating and energy. And they're now even talking about electricity, what we can do. So I use him as an example, this gentleman, Mr. Walker. But there is, like I said, it's a very competitive nature. And I can only see really good things coming out of being adopted not only out in greater Minnesota but all over. It is quite adaptable. Actually, this gentleman is going to makes these biomass pellets out of plant material and animal product, and he's delivering it already like water softener pellets. And so they have a connection right into the house, and every month you get your energy needs. You don't even have to mess with the bags or anything. And it's quite innovative. He's doing some neat things, like I said, with the electrical issue, too, electricity. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, I totally support this. When my first home, we used wood to heat our home. And they were just developing the pellets at the time. We discontinued because there was a possible link with my daughter's ear infections. But I think this is a great thing to be trying to develop and research.
Exactly. And the whole thank you, Senator Johnson, the whole issue with these stoves, they have gotten to be quite lovely.
Yes, exactly. They were, mine was beautiful.
They were they're very pretty. They come in different kind of colors, and they are a piece of furniture in your home. Of course, I'm talking about Bixby Energy, but like I said, the competition is there, and everybody is ramping up. And our whole focus in the committee I sit on is the greenhouse emissions, CO2, lowering our CO2, and what we can do better. We're passing an efficiency bill out of that committee, and I think this is all part of the equation, and it's another important tool.
Mr. Rosen, it's probably more colorful stuff than to talk about taxes all morning.
But this is a fun bill, Mr. Chair.
Anything else, members? Senator Rosen, anything to add?
No, Mr. Chair. I hope you do consider it this year, or I will be back next year with Mr. Walker, because I do think this is exciting for us all in Minnesota.
Didn't we have something in the bill last year or year before?
No, Mr. Chair, we didn't.
We never made it?
No.
Oh, I'd love the teaser. Senator Rosen, it usually helps when you have a bill that's going to be directly referred to the Tax Committee if you have a member of the Tax Committee as an author. Little inside tip.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just looking at people.
And you get an advocate on the on the committee.
I do, Mr. Chair.
Just a little tip.
Senator Johnson.
We're good friends. without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 1204 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You, Senator.
Members, thank you.
Senator Orban, you want to go today or Monday?
I'll be brief.
Okay.
Actually, tomorrow, too.
Senator Ortman, Senate File 195.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing this bill today. This is the tuition tax credit, the universal tuition tax credit that we talked about a little bit on the Senate floor, one of our first days in debate. And it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of people behind me, but there are a ton of people behind me on this bill. Starting with our caucus members, we had a caucus discussion about this. This is a bill that our caucus supports. It's a use of one-time money or can be a long-term approach. What it does is it creates a $1,000 tax credit for tuition expenses. Tuition expenses that would include K-12, all-day kindergarten and K-12 expenses, but predominantly for post-secondary and graduate students. And if you look at the fiscal note, members, you'll see there's just a slight fiscal impact here. If we spend $629 million in the reserve, we can spend the rest on this, and we're still good to go. there is a significant financial impact here, $376 million. But it is the best $376 million we could spend in the state of Minnesota with our one-time money. You'll see why. It's because of the big impact on Minnesotans. This will hit every income category. It will hit almost every family in the state of Minnesota. It will hit all of our districts. And it will support investments in education, investments in all-day kindergarten, which we are not going to pay for in our K-12 bill. We don't have the money for it. It will allow for those people that are already paying for private and schools and charter schools, whatever their expenses are related to tuition, they're already paying for it, they will see a tax credit. More importantly, it will definitely boost our students in post-secondary schools, not just MinSCU, but also VOTEC schools and graduate programs. This is an incentive for them, and it's also a reward. If we're going to try to refund some of the money that we have at the state gathered in a surplus, not as much as we'd like, I would argue that the best way to spend that money is through our educational system, because then the workforce benefits, our businesses benefit, Minnesota families benefit. As I've said before, I'm concerned about the savings. Minnesota families don't have as much savings as they've had in years past, and nationwide we're in a lot of trouble. This would relieve some of that burden, and it would create a positive incentive. If you look at the fiscal note, 4,707 students already enrolled in all-day kindergarten would benefit.
But we have a lot of families that would like to enroll their kids in all-day kindergarten. They just can't afford it. This would help. 98,000 in elementary and secondary school. But the big hit, I think, is the 364,000 that we have in post-secondary schools. That's graduate and undergraduate. We can't do anything about tuition. We just passed the bill last year. We don't have the money. This would absolutely help families, all families, afford education in the state of Minnesota. I'd ask you to think about putting our money where our mouth is. We say we value education. This is the best way to do it. It's a little frustrating that we find it so hard to do big, important things, and we find ourselves in the tax committee doing little things. You know, like the tax credit for biomass is $1 million, and we've got all the other tax credits and sales tax exemptions we've heard today. I admit this is a big thing, but it's an important thing, and it can be adjusted. This bill is set up as a draft for $1,000 per family, but it could be reduced to $500 per beneficiary. We could cut this bill in half, and we could implement it over time. So we could start with one big section. There are ways that we could adjust this, and I hope the committee would consider this. I think that Minnesotans would be so pleased to see us make this a priority in the state of Minnesota. We would be a nation leader if we did this. It would be a very wise policy for our future and for our families and for people that are looking for self-improvement. This is the best way to do it.
Senator Ortman, this is an interesting fiscal note because on the back of it, they identify about 23,152 Minnesota residents enrolled in public post-secondary schools in other states. And then they say that the bill as written would allow them to get the credit, but that the credit is not included in the estimate. I don't know why revenue didn't include it in there. I mean, that because if they're allowed, that raises the fiscal note on this bill significantly, I would think. Somebody from revenue here? Or do we lose them all? I don't understand why, if we know how many students are out of state that would be eligible, why we wouldn't have included them in the fiscal note.
Well, and when we estimated it at our caucus, Mr. Chair, we estimated a higher number for that very reason. And then the Department of Revenue came up with this. I think trying to estimate it is a difficult thing, because we don't necessarily keep track of all these numbers, and certainly not all in one place, the people that would be eligible for a tax credit like this. So there's probably some adjustment here. It might cost a little more, a little bit less. It's going to take some time for people to become aware of it, I think. But I would hope that the committee would not just disregard this proposal because it's expensive. It's a good proposal, and maybe we can do it incrementally.
I mean, I would just, looking at the summary, I'd guess, you know, maybe another $30 million or so, probably. Just an interesting fiscal note, the fact that they made that
and
note
Mr.
that
Chair,
they're included, but not, that they're under the bill, but not included in the estimate.
Mr. Chair, that's why our research estimated this cost at $471 million, as opposed to $376. I think you did a pretty good job. I think with the fiscal note, you'll see that it's $376 million in the first year, but it's not just, if we did this as a one-time thing, it would be $376, and the bill was drafted as a one-time, because if you remember, we offered it as an amendment on the Senate floor, but that would be a continuing expense over time, and it probably would have some tails as more students participated, more families took advantage of it. There's definitely a fiscal impact here. But I think that it's the right thing to do, again, talking about reprioritizing the way we spend our money.
Senator Sundrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman, I noticed the last bullet on the second page, it talks about the credit being retroactive to 2006. Would it be generally fair to say that if we just made this a proactive bill, that it would be half the cost? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think that's fair to say because we've got a 2000. Well, it's a 2008 fiscal note. But we could make it active after we could say that 2007 investments are eligible, or we could say that 2008 investments are eligible, and we could push this fiscal note out. But again, you have to recognize that it's a significant fiscal note, and
sure.
But there are ways to adjust this to make it more palatable currently.
Very expensive.
Mr. Chair, yes, but a very good program.
Senator Ortman, I promised you I was going to hear the bill. And I almost forgot, because I'm not sure we had a hearing request.
Mr. Chair, I think we did.
Okay. Well, in any event, I promise
you
I was
going to hear. But I appreciate the hearing on the bill, and I hope that the members will consider this. The whole idea of a tuition tax credit is something I've been working on for 4 years. And the first year I offered it just for K-12, and it received 31 votes on the Senate floor. 33 votes, excuse me, on the Senate floor. There is a lot of support for really putting some money into education. If we can't do it directly, then maybe going an indirect route this way through recognizing the investments that Minnesotans are making makes a lot of sense.
Well, Senator Ortman, I have expressed many times to the State Chamber of Commerce, at what point in time are they going to get themselves engaged in the debate about tuition in this state? Because the path that we're on, we're not very far from young people having to face a decision whether they can afford going to college or not. And you know, there's only so much debt you can come out of there with. And I know people, the $30,000, $40,000 in debt coming out of college from public institutions. And it's just unacceptable. And I hope that we can rally more people around the idea that higher education is important, and the state has an important role to play in trying to keep it affordable. Because, you know, the citizens lose when people don't have an opportunity for higher education, and the business community certainly loses. Because, I mean, if that next generation of workers isn't prepared for the workforce, somebody's going to invest in them. And if we didn't as a state, then future employers are going to have to invest in them to make sure they have the right skill set to be productive members of our community and productive for the employer. So I've expressed it over and over to the chamber, and I'm hoping that at some point we can come together, myself and the chamber, with some kind of a proposal to address the rising tuition issue. Because I think it's one of the bigger challenges that the business community in this state faces, you know, along with transportation.
Mr. Chair, I would just add, it's the biggest issue for families, too. Many of us here are baby boomers, and my children are 15, 14, 12, and 9, and they all want to go to college. And I look at the tuition rates that were huge when I went to college. It's just, it's daunting for parents to look at the expenses of college and try and make it a goal for their family and are struggling with debt in the families and everything else to try and pay for college. And somehow we have to ease the pain here. And I think this may be one of the ways we could do it.
Senator Steven?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the bill and the discussion on this. I just wanted to get your comment, Senator Ortman, on the all-day kindergarten piece. And I represent a couple districts where they offer all-day kindergarten, but only on a fee basis. And, you know, I hear from many, many parents who want to send their children to all-day kindergarten but can't afford it. So what's the benefit? How does it help those parents or those families who really need some sort of relief, either by the state providing funding so all districts can have all-day kindergarten or, you know, through some type of tax credit? But if this is a one-time thing, those families aren't served or aren't helped. So why not give the money that we would be expending here to the districts so that they can offer more scholarships or help extend service so that more families who are on the edge or can't afford to go can do so?
Mr. Chair and Senator Steven, I really appreciate that question. The bill was drafted as a one-time, but I think that the best approach here, if the committee is going to seriously find some money to pay for this, would be to make it an ongoing tuition tax credit. You know, let people know, and then they're going to be able to take advantage of it in the future and plan for it in the future, which is actually the way I've always drafted the bill. And this is the first time we ever did it this way, just because we offered it as an amendment on the floor, if you remember, so that we could take advantage of the surplus. But I think it should be an ongoing program, and what would happen is the folks that pay for the tuition, the expenses for all-day kindergarten, they then get a tax credit on their off of their earnings. So they document their earnings, they get a $1,000 tax credit dollar for dollar. So if they spend $900, they get $900 off of their tax their payable taxes. If they're actually, they don't owe taxes, they can actually get a refund. So those at the lowest income level, actually, and that's true for all the tuition levels, whether it's graduate students or anyone else, if they don't owe that much in taxes, the state writes a check up to $1,000 to incentivize them for doing what we think they should do, which is get the all-day kindergarten programs and go forward with education. And so I think this is a way to counterbalance what we can't do with our direct tuition. I think that's a good program for all of these levels.
Senator Ortman, have you ever thought about means testing it?
Well, Mr. Chair,
we could reduce the cost.
And I wouldn't be opposed to that. And we could go back through and work through a revenue estimate to say, and you know, maybe looking at like the top tier income tax or income level or something like that, and say people under that qualify for that. And we could maybe cut this down that way, and I'd be interested in looking at that, and I'd get back with you on some of the ways to maybe break down this huge number.
It just seems we need to make it a little more doable if we're going to try and do something. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This isn't to the bill. It was to the tax chair's comment about finding ways to help our young adults. A trend that I've noticed touring the community colleges with my son recently and also sitting on the Anoka Technical Foundation board is employers are coming to the table and saying we need this many Class 5 iron workers for this project, and they are taking care of the tuitions on those. And for instance, with what my son chose, we were instructed not to plan to sign up for the next phase because in a lot of cases the employer will send the, you know, once you've worked in the field for a while, they'll send you through the continuing ed part of it. So I think that's a trend that the workforce is starting to address.
Anything else, Senator Ortman?
No, thank you, members and Mr. Chair.
Without objection, Chair lays over Senate File 195 for possible inclusion. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. Monday morning, tomorrow. Tomorrow we have the E-12 budget bill in front of us. There's property tax issues. That's a bill that always comes to the Tax Committee before it goes to the floor. Tomorrow we're taking up E-12. Sorry about the Saturday meeting, but our Easter recess is approaching quickly. And then Monday we're going to take up the public finance bill and go through that. There probably are some things members might want to take out of that. I understand there's not agreement on everything that's in there. We then will do two things with the public finance bill. We'll probably carry a public finance article in the tax bill, how it's normally done, and then probably hold the bill here and see if anything else appears during the session, and we might want to include in the standalone bill and send it out by itself later. So that's where we're at, and the hope is to get a tax bill out of here Wednesday or Thursday next week to the floor. This meeting's adjourned.